Yep. Okay, we're recording. Done it again, but this time it's teamwork.
Oh yeah, are we done? We finished?
I think so. What you mean the clicking of the buttons?
Oh, I gotta click some buttons. I've been meaning to ask actually. Are you still are you still using the trackball?
Yes, I am. I've got it right here.
Still the same one as well.
It's the same. These things last forever, and when I say forever, I mean like 20 years
Literally.
forever.
Yeah. No,
Yeah.
I recently I've been using the mouse more because I always go to when I play like an FPS for a bit, I start using the mouse 40 FPS and then I forget to stop using it, and then after a while I'm like, I just use the mouse. And then inevitably I miss trackballs and I get the trackball out again. And like, yeah, this is one of those. I've got the trackball out again. I've been using it more. Mine's the slim blade that you can't see because this is so dark today for some
It's,
reason.
yeah, it's because you're sinister. We're trying to evoke, I'm the good, I'm the angel, you're the
Heaven
devil, basically.
and hell.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, my camera's always dark, but it's not usually quite this dark.
It's all right,
Yeah.
like it's good. It's a look. But yeah, no, the only thing about this trackball I don't quite like is that it doesn't have a scroll wheel. And more as the days go by, as the years go by, there's more and more things that require a scroll wheel, and I find weirder and weirder ways of getting past it. Sometimes you've got, because of like all the frameworks of the CSS frameworks that every website and every app and whatever every uses now, sometimes you have to like click on a bit to select the background and then do page up, page down or something. I use a mouse with a mouse wheel on my Mac at work in my office because the trackballs don't seem to do so well on Mac for reasons I'm not entirely certain about.
That's
They
interesting.
work, but like
Yeah.
you don't get the sensitivity as high as I tend to like it. So
Right. Yeah.
not
Yeah, no, with
entirely
the
sure
trackball,
why.
you do sensitivity pretty high, don't you? I love scrolling on that. So mine's a Kensington Slim Blade. And I love the way you scroll on this. You just rotate the ball along its that axis. You just rotate it side, and it also, I don't know if you can hear this, I might have to talk so that you can hear it. Can you hear that little click? Blah 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 blah
Sorry.
blah blah. There's a little click when you rotate it, which is entirely electronic. That's not mechanical.
It's not. That's an electronic click.
It's an electronic click telling you are rotating the ball and scrolling, and it's such a nice way to scroll. I tried to go to the Kensington Expert, the more kind of rugged looking one, and that has a ring that you move to scroll, and that is so far less satisfying. If I'm bored just listening to something, I just spin this wheel and it just like scrolls the page like up and down like this, and it's just a satisfying thing to do. And that, I mean, that's the thing with trackball. Like, it's so, I don't think that trackballs are necessarily better for a lot of things. Anything precise, they're not better, but they are so much more comfortable.
That's yeah, I mean, we use obviously computers a lot in day-to-day life, and having something that my biggest reason for having it these days is to like maintain, like health, really. Like is having something
Sure.
comfortable, having something where you can choose your own positioning and be quite flexible with it. That's fine. Like it's not necessarily an efficiency thing or anything other than that. It's just like the tendons in your forearm. You don't want to have to go to the doctor about those
No.
if it can be avoided. It's so that's really kind of it. I do sometimes look around for other possible trackballs, but I've been using this style of trackball now for going on 20 years. You get so comfortable in it. You get so in your ways that you feel a bit like out in the woods without it. Now, I've not n not that's not necessarily a continuous 20 years. There have been times when I've used laptops and things like that, and I've gotten used to trackpads and other travel mice and things like that. But home, there has always been this track mouse. And the funny thing about it is that I never it, the original one that I had, which I have still got around here somewhere, it came with a magazine subscription. That's how I came into it,
Hang
and
on,
I
sorry.
just.
Did you got the mouse with the magazine, or you got the magazine with the mouse?
The well
Trackball.
the it depends how you want to look at it, right? Because I actually was like, oh, if I subscribe to this magazine, I get this mouse. So I kind of like the promotional offer kind of worked on me, I think, at the time.
That's actually great. I love that.
And I got a new one after it started playing up after about 15 years, And then it turned out I just needed to like open it up and give it an inside clean, and then it was fine again. So now I've got three of these that are all working.
I actually gave this one a clean, because when I was last using it, the right click, it became a bit sporadic. So I took it apart. I was going to do it with alcohol, but I didn't have any alcohol. So I poured lighter fluid into the switch and then just left it overnight. And in the morning, it worked perfectly. So I don't recommend that necessarily, but it worked.
No, that's. Well,
I was just going to say that it's so tactile, like compared to a mouse that you're just sort of dragging around the desk. It feels luxurious just leaning back and just moving your fingertips. And I just, like, again, when I'm bored, I literally pull the ball out and just sort of twiddle with it in my hands and then just put it, because on this trackball, you can just lift it out. Just do that and then drop it down and do some more stuff. And then, if I'm thinking, I just sort of like mash the button. But yeah. It's great.
It's all right. Yeah, but it is to me. It's the sort of the comfy pair of slippers type of thing. It's like I'm well aware that it's probably neither the best trackball or anything.
I know what you're saying, but people do. I've got yours up on screen at the moment. It's the marble mouse, right? The optical marble. Well, the marble mouse. Yeah, people love those. No, you see, like. You see posts online, people just sort of like, essentially writing sonnets to these things. They adore them, yeah. And I see why. Like, it is a unique shape. I think Elecom do one that's a similar shape now, don't they?
There's more to it as well than the shape. Like, the build quality, you know where you are with it.
Yeah.
It's a Black & Decker mouse, as it were, Like, it's... I remember the early days of laser optical mice and them not being too great, and that has kind of a little bit like stayed with me when it comes to those kind of mice, that I never feel like on firm footing. I always feel like there could be, that it's just like it's dependent on the surface that you're on, whereas with these,
yeah,
it's dependent on nothing other than gravity, really,
as long as gravity is working, they're all good. No, for sure.
Yeah.
I remember, and the Logitech ones are good. Like, I think Logitech stuff is hit or miss in terms of quality. But I think, the Logitech trackballs have always been good. Like, years back, I had one of the ones where it's kind of shaped like a mouse, and the ball's on your thumb.
I don't like those ones.
I did really like that one back in the day. I know I stopped.
It's so much work on the thumb. So much work on the thumb.
Yeah. I do prefer this one, which is fingers.
Yeah, if the thumb's doing all the work, it feels, I don't know, like unhealthy or not good for the hand, if you know what I mean. It's
just feels stretchy.
The thing I like about the finger based ball is you can stretch your hand in any direction and it still kind of works,
And you use, like, I don't know if it's the same with your one, but with my one, I'm using this part of my fingers.
I don't. I'm tipsy.
I don't think you can use these ones with. I guess you could, but it's more. Yeah, your hand is basically flat on the thing, and you just.
I have used like further down the finger.
Yeah.
For gaming, if I'm playing, with like Morrowind or Oblivion or something like that, where you just kind of want to
lean back and .
It does feel natural, and it does have four buttons on it, although it is kind of I say this is not interesting, but this is a bit of trivia about it, is that you've got mouse button one, mouse button two, left and right, and then you've got mouse button four and mouse button five. There is no mouse button three.
What would three be?
Three would be when you click down the mouse wheel.
Right, yeah, okay.
But there is no mouse wheel, so it doesn't determine that... because naturally on a browser will interpret mouse button 4 as back and mouse button 5 as forward.
Yeah.
Which is how this works. So, which is kind of not very useful, because the frequency to which I use the back button in browsing it does not warrant a mouse.
Yeah, button. See, I use the back a lot, but I don't use the forward at all. So mine's got four buttons. So I've mapped left, right, back button, and middle click, because I need middle click for opening new tab. It's not the another trackball that I have that never really took to so much was the Elecom Huge.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Which, for anyone watching the videos, this one, I'll link you a picture. That one, which has 7 million buttons.
Oh, that looks kind of cool.
It's cool, yeah. The build quality doesn't feel as solid as the Kensington ones, or probably the Logitech ones either. The ball feels quite light. But if you want one, I mean, most people gaming are not going to use a trackball. But if you want a trackball that you can game on comfortably, that's a good one, because it's got so many buttons.
Does it have a firm like grip with the table? Because sometimes they don't, and that can be.
Yeah. Plus, it's heavy enough that even if it weren't, it's got the scroll wheel on the thumb, which isn't the most comfortable. I think it's got four buttons where the thumb is, and then it's got two on the right, two just to the left of the ball, plus the middle click on the thumb. It's got so many buttons. It's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's good. It's good. Trackball.
Yeah. I'm not used to the gaming mouse multiple buttons. I don't know how much habit forming it will take to get me into it.
I think for FPSs, I always, anything first person-y, or I guess anything sort of action-y, I do always map the back and forward button on the mouse. So that's when I go to a mouse for gaming. But for like the vast majority of games I play, like left, right, and middle, you're good.
Yeah. Although, for button four on my back, I use in Oblivion, I use it as spell casting.
Yeah. No, I do the same thing. Yeah. And I think the forward button on my mouse is has always been ready weapon in Morrowind.
Mm. I cannot wait, actually, until the new OpenMW. I'm going to totally do maybe even a series of videos when OpenMW comes out. The new OpenMW with the extra shadows and all the other kind. It looks really good, but it's gone. The final stages of it seems to have taken longer than I was expecting, maybe. So I don't know if they're just taking extra longer to like iron out the bugs, or things have come up. Or
what's going in? What's going into the new one? What's going to be there?
It's a lot of it is just like lighting and shadows, which just like kind of look phenomenal. The release candidate is now in release candidate phase. They've got some huge news. Let's see. Launcher improvements. Oh, they do. Oh. There's a VR fork of it.
Oh, really?
That's
Nothing's ever made me want VR until I heard that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love the multiplayer. That's great. Oh, they're planning on, but I don't think that's for this release, but I think there is talk about them bringing in the multiplayer Morrowind into the main OpenMW.
Ooh. We should carry on with that. We were doing a playthrough, weren't we, with the open with the multiplayer. What's it called?
Morrowind multiplayer, MWMP.
It's got a better name than that, isn't it? I feel like the name was in my head until I went to say it.
It's something like MWMP or something, right?
That would be a good name.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, we should pick that up again.
Oh, definitely. Do like some Thieves Guild quests Temple quests.
Yes.
It could be some God Botherers.
Yes, that would be great. That would be awesome. I love those.
Yeah. But it's one I've been keeping an eye on. To be fair, it's been the whole release has been in the works for quite a while now.
A long time ago, they reached the point of just if I wanted to play Morrowind, I would default to OpenMW's. No reason to use old Morrowind anymore.
Mm.
It's perfectly stable, the entire game's in there. I mean, I know there's tiny little things that are missing, but I never noticed them.
Now it's I think pretty much feature complete, and like they're doing things, you know, like they've got God rays and ambient occlusion, HDR ready, bloom. all the stuff that like sort of modern-ish games have.
Yeah.
So that's
going to be fun. I kind of love it with the old, because it's, I mean, yeah, we've talked about this endlessly, but Morrowind's one of those games that like, I know that when people see it for the first time, they're like, oh my God, that's so ugly. And I'm like, Morrowind's so beautiful. Like, it's such a beautiful, it's so gorgeous. Like, I don't know. I guess that must be nostalgia in some way. But like, I do think like, you know, I've got a screenshot up now with like the mushroom buildings and the mushroom houses. It's just, it's well designed, and that makes it beautiful, even if, you know, even if it's three polygons.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think there's a lot that goes into Morrowind that makes it what it is. I think atmosphere is a, during that era, atmosphere in games was a big focus.
Yeah.
Just having a world that just felt like its own thing. Because you saw it with Deus Ex. If you ask a lot of like big gamers around that time what the thing that Deus Ex brought to the table, they said it was the atmosphere. The plot is interesting and quirky and good, and that, you know, it's all right. It doesn't drop that down. The gameplay is not really that great. The voice acting, whilst quite good for the time, has not aged particularly well.
Hilarious in places.
I spill my drink.
a bomb.
And so I like, by all accounts, Deus Ex should not have aged that well. But because it has a, and also, like, interestingly enough, the soundtrack's kind of,
soundtrack's great, actually. Yeah,
the soundtrack is great. But I don't know if I mentioned this in the last episode, because I've been like talking about this to a lot of people non-stop. But I got the this album off Bandcamp called Conspiravision, which the original makers of the soundtrack for Deus Ex, apparently, right, because it uses, I think it's like the Unreal way of doing music, which is a bit like MIDI, but you use real samples, I think it is.
Yeah.
So you get like, so it's this like halfway between MIDI and like an MP3. So the original creators, they went out and they basically created the soundtrack in their own, you know, as right, with modern ways of doing things. And it's amazing. I really quite enjoy it. I put it in the car, like whenever I don't want to listen to a podcast, whenever I want something that's just less talky, you know, it always goes on. And it's not a like for like recreation of Deus Ex. It's not trying to like, it's a reimagining, it's a reinterpretation. It's something a bit like new, sort of inspired by it. You've still got like the beats. You've still got that, you know, that little rhythm you've got when you go into Yanako for the first time. It's got the Synapse one where you go into Hong Kong for the first time. It's got, it does have the original theme tune, but it's more subtle, more layers to it.
It's a reimagining of the exact same thing, right? It's retained the feel, retained the mood, and made it a bit less 8-bit WAV, I guess, is what, I don't know, whatever they were using back then.
Yeah, pretty much. I think it's really quite good. Because it. Yeah, and the one I like the most, which they've actually kept quite true to the original, is the New York, that background New York gameplay, with the little like weird whine in the background.
It is. Deus Ex is amazing in a lot of ways. I agree. Like mood is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. I think you're underplaying its mechanical, like. It's toy box kind of sandboxy play around kind of, you know, different ways of getting it. That was also new. And
level design was the best. Like
level design, but the tools you had to do stuff in the level.
Yeah. But then I think that was more like, would you not say that's more game design rather than when I think of the mechanics, I'm thinking of the gunplay really, which everyone agrees is not, it's not even supposed to be that good, really.
No, the gunplay is unique.
Yeah.
Mechanics, you interacting with the level is mechanics. It's level design. But I was going to say, but also that, just when you open it up, you know that thing with, you know, somebody mentions Deus Ex and you're like, oh, I've got to play Deus Ex again. So you play Deus Ex for a morning. Yeah. And just that first time you open it up, and that just that intro theme that hits you immediately, just like, oh my God, I'm back in there. I'm just straight back in there. It's such a good intro theme.
And
the spinning logo as well is just so, I don't know what it is about its combination. Maybe it's because the game is so good that we grow attached to the iconography and the sounds, or maybe they're really good as well. I'm really not sure at this point. I'm too deep in, you know what I mean? But
I'm probably the same, but I think that's the value that an atmosphere can bring to a game.
That
it immerses you in a way that is not necessarily tangible or not necessarily even recognizable. And it's not until someone mentions, oh, something Deus Ex, well, I'm gonna go, is that the game that the meme's based on? Every time someone talks about Deus Ex, someone goes back and installs
it. I always forget
which
game as well about Morrowind and Oblivion and probably Skyrim and stuff, but I think Deus Ex is the progenitor.
It is like
Morrowind and Deus Ex for us, like it's being in love. And you know, when you're in love, you can't judge what you're in love with accurately because you're in love. You know, it's got that kind of thing, right? I can't at this point tell you whether the graphics in Deus Ex are amazing or terrible. You know what I mean? Because I'm so in love with them.
Yeah. I think, with Deus Ex, it comes just before the bad lip syncing games.
Yeah.
So it kind of looks good by comparison, because they're like, I mean, Oblivion is the chief of this, where they have enough polygons, you know, they've discovered enough polygons where they can actually do proper voice lips, and they overdo it. They make it so that every syllable is overemphasized. Mm-hmm. Although one game that does do this quite well is the second Deus Ex game, Invisible War, where they have very slight, like it's still puppety, but they have very slight inclinations to certain syllables.
And Invisible War was great in a lot of ways.
Oh, I will defend it a lot. Like I think Oblivion.
That part of the problem with Oblivion is, I agree with what you're saying. Like the overemphasis on certain syllables with them, but also you just, these potato faces that you get in Oblivion talking, they're just, it's always monstrous. Like it's
not... yeah. And the thing is, all of the characters kind of look the same. You know, there's like, even though you can make it so that their eyes are like, you know,
incredibly far
apart, or they still look the same. It's kind of strange. Like if someone managed to do a mod where they could put the world of Oblivion and everything about it into Morrowind, then that'd be great. That would suit.
I don't know. It's like when people make was Oblivion or something. When they made, this is the other way around. This is they made Morrowind world inside Oblivion.
Yeah,
but again, it's part of what I love about Morrowind is all the mechanics, all the, like, I can wear 17 pieces of armor or however many it is, and that I can enchant every piece of armor with a unique spell, which you can't do any of that in Oblivion. So like, when they remade Morrowind inside Skyrim, it's like, that's just like a picture of Morrowind. It's not Morrowind.
Yeah. Although to be fair, with Oblivion did have some things over Morrowind. It had the Thieves Guild quests, which I think the Thieves Guild quests are in Oblivion. I like the Thieves Guild quests in Morrowind. I thought they were on the whole very good, except for maybe the last stages of it, which basically became kill this person, kill that person, kill this person.
Yeah. Especially given that when you join the Thieves Guild in Morrowind, that it's all about, like, we don't kill people. We're not murderers. You know, we're not assassins. We don't do that. You've got to avoid killing people. I think did you get less reward if you killed people on the jobs? Was that Morrowind? Was that Oblivion? But that's definitely part of the lore, right? Yeah, we don't kill people. And then the last few missions are like, kill this person, kill this person, kill this.
Yeah, it's the leader of the Morrowind Thieves Guild is definitely but with Oblivion, of course, like the final mission, you have to steal all these different bits and then end up with the equipment to pull off a really quite interesting heist, which links in to like the main theme of the whole series, right? You steal an Elder Scroll, which is like that, and that comes together really well. Also, and I didn't really realize this until someone relayed it to me, that they really liked how in In Oblivion, you have to get recommendations from all of the guilds in order to actually get into the Arcane University, and they all have their individual little quests and
all like that. Once you get there, I like the Thieves Guild stuff very much. That last Thieves Guild mission, I mean, you should probably say, like, the early Thieves Guild missions are just, they're gated by how much value of stuff you've stolen.
Yeah.
Which, like, when we go back and play it now, we know all the stuff to steal. Like, it's easy. But, like, for somebody, you know, playing it for the first time, like, that's tedious. It's very tedious. That's no fun at all.
Yeah, but I clocked on pretty quickly to rob the jewelry shop and then...
Yeah, then just sell it all to the same fence.
It's like, yeah, but buy a load of lockpicks, auto complete until you get into the jewelry shop at night. Take everything, and it was great that, like, if you just had enough lockpicks, you could auto chance it or whatever it is until it opened.
Yeah. Ding ding ding
ding. Yeah,
yeah.
And also, that'd be a great way to level up the security.
That last mission makes it all worth it because you're sneaking through the palace to begin with, and then some sewers, and I think you even go past the cell you start at or something, don't you? And somebody. Is that the same? Am I thinking the same thing, or is that Dark Brotherhood?
You go, in the Dark Brotherhood, you go back into the cell you started at to kill the person.
Right, right.
But I think in the Thieves Guild, you go near it.
I remember a voice saying, like, oh, but you know all about that, don't you?
That would be the Dark Brotherhood.
Okay, right. I'm confused.
But the Dark Brotherhood missions are great as well.
Yeah, they are great as well.
Yeah, so...
But I should probably state it in Morrowind. Like, we've both said that the Thieves Guild quests are fun, but in Morrowind, a lot of the quests are just fetch quests. They just go to this dungeon, either deliver this thing from person A to person B, or go to this dungeon and kill X person or get X thing. Like, the quests in and of themselves are not particularly interesting, but. And I think this is really important. Morrowind gives you such a big, because it's not voice. I think that's really important because you're just reading text when you come back to hand your quest in. There's so much space for your imagination to work, and you attach so much character to these people you're dealing with. I genuinely, the characters in Morrowind, the quest givers in Morrowind, I felt like I had such a relationship with them compared to Oblivion, where they voice it more, and especially Skyrim, where it's, you know, it's fully voiced and acted. And the quests. You know, the quest structure, you know, as level designs or whatever, the quests are better in Oblivion and Skyrim, honestly. But that narrative, it's not even narrative, is it? It's but that immersive, again, mood layer in Morrowind just means so much.
Yeah. And I think part of Morrowind's benefit is how you moved around the world. You had the Siltstriders, which is like your public transport, which is reasonably priced as well, you know, so it wasn't something, you know, it wasn't a get out of jail free card, or it wasn't a shortcut per se. And then you had the boats as well. And because it worked on an island, like, there was geographical relevance to all of the places.
Yeah.
And so that built up its own little, or that helped you, that gave you a bit of a canvas to start putting the story on top of. And getting to the places was itself an adventure. And I think the few things the Morrowind did, I do think that if you put the World of Oblivion into Morrowind with the same sort of similar mechanics, I think you'd fix a lot of Oblivion's problems. Because the thing is with Oblivion, you had fast travel. It doesn't even have any kind of, like, plot reason. It's just like, oh, well, you're just going to walk or ride your horse there, and we're just going to skip
teleportation,
that time.
Right? Yeah, it's...
Yeah.
The problem with fast travel is, there always comes a point in the game where you're tempted, you're like, I'm tired, I want to go to bed, like, I'm just going to use it this once. But as soon as you use it, you're going to be using it from that point onwards. And it just destroys space.
Yeah.
Which means that you never have that feeling of going on a journey. And Morrowind kind of, maybe by accident, maybe by design, it's just absolutely perfect. The combination of no map markers, vague directions, often incredibly vague and sometimes even actually wrong. So you can never get, you couldn't teleport to exactly where you needed to go for the quest. And secondly, you would look at the map and you would plan your journey. You'd go, okay, I'm going to Silt Strider from here to here. I'll take the boat from there to there, catch another Silt Strider across to there. And then even late game, like, might even use the Pro Pylon Chambers, might even use Elmisi Intervention, or like, you're putting a journey together in your head, and then you're doing that. And then you've still got to do the final leg on foot, and that felt like a journey.
Is the Pro Pylon stuff in the original game, or is that in the Game of the Year edition? I think
that's in the original game. Yeah, you just find the indexes, these little keys for the Pro Pylon Chambers, and then you can use, I think if you have a key, you can either travel to or from it, and if you've got all of them, you can travel from any Pro Pylon Chamber to any other Pro Pylon Chamber, I think, from memory.
I never end up doing I did them once many years ago.
I think I got it only on one playthrough. Yeah, I mean, you don't really need them, but it's just a nice sort of extra.
Well, once you get your magic key stuff up and running, then you earn your horse, basically, isn't it?
I mean, you get to the point in Morrowind when you've enchanted all your gear that you're like, you can leap. I can basically leap from Belmora to what's the big city out in the water with all the square? Vivec. Yeah. I can just leap to Vivec anyway. So
yeah. And you build, it's amazing how you like build up the world, and each place has its own character. One of the things about Oblivion as well that did really take it just drained the immersion out of me is that you would come across this village in the middle of nowhere, and there it would either very clearly be there for like the sole purpose of being a point on a quest, or almost as if it was just copy pasted in and no one has anything to say.
Yeah. The former was the worst. Like, you stumbled on a place and it looked like there was clearly something interesting set up there. Like, the characters would say, oh, that, I don't like that family. They're doing blah, blah, blah. And you talk to them and they go, I don't like that. But, you know, clearly something was set up, but because you hadn't triggered the quest, you couldn't engage with it. And it felt like, I don't know, it's that theme parky feel, right? You've stumbled upon a ride that isn't complete yet or something like that.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, yeah. So, right. Anyway, should we talk about Elon Musk buying Twitter?
I noted down some questions to keep us focused on this. So, why did he buy it? What does it mean for Twitter? What does it mean for the Fediverse? I think that'll keep us focused, right?
There's a part of me that thinks that he bought it because he was originally doing a bit of bravado and then kind of talked himself into it.
He got drunk one night. People get drunk and then buy something on Amazon and don't remember. On Twitter, he woke up the next morning and was like, oh, shit.
Kind of. He seems very fueled by the small stuff in his life, right?
Yeah.
Almost like petty kings of law, right? Off with his head type of thing. And it just feels like he probably had a falling out with someone, or he felt like someone he liked got banned, or he felt like he couldn't say whatever he wanted to say. And it's like, well, you know what? I'm going to buy it. And I think they got a point where he tried to back out of it, realizing that 44 billion or whatever it was like, that's not a good use of my money. Like, he got buyer's remorse.
It's not a good price for Twitter either, is it? By all, I mean, I know something like Twitter is incredibly hard to put a value on, but yeah, his worth, I think, before he bought Twitter was 220 billion, which is infinity money.
Yeah.
Infinity times infinity money. Like, it doesn't matter. He can spend 44 billion on a drunk purchase and it doesn't matter, which is just obscene in itself.
Yeah. I don't think he did it for any monetary reasons.
No.
He might try and like do things to keep advertisers happy in order to like not have it.
Well, initially upon talking about buying it or saying he was going to buy it, he said he was going to get rid of the advertising. He's backtracked on that, but he said he was going to get rid of the advertising.
He's backtracked on that, but he's also backtracked quite far on that, saying that he wants to do extra targeted advertising.
Yeah, no, I saw that. Yeah. I'm like, I think what he's trying to say. Well, what he literally said in that announcement was that if advertising is well targeted, then it's content, which is complete horrendous bullshit. I think that's how they're thinking now up in the towers of whatever Silicon Valley. I think he bought it because I mean Elon Musk. I mean, it's also complicated. Obviously, I do not like Elon Musk. As a person, he just seems like a very arrogant, egotistical. I mean, you have to become a billionaire, I would think. On top of that, he's a billionaire, so he's obviously evil.
Obviously,
the stuff he's doing. I mean, I will say, in comparison to somebody like Bezos,
mm-hmm.
Musk. I don't like the innovations that he's doing, but he is actually making innovate. He is actually trying to make a usable electric car. He's bought companies that have kind of revolutionized space travel in some ways. I don't like that stuff being in private hands. Electric cars aren't a solution for climate change in any world whatsoever. So, you know, I have problems with all that, but in comparison to Bezos, who just put shopping on the internet, there's a joke in Silicon Valley about that there's an asshole billionaire who just made a billion back in the early days of the internet by putting radio on the web basically. And they sort of take the piss out of that, and I think, you know, yeah, Bezos is he just put shopping on the internet and has done nothing since, you know, and then bought the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post run.
I mean, Elon Musk makes, you know, his mouth makes what's the expression, his mouth writes a lot of checks that you can't cash, right? Like I would love to have seen the Hyperloop sort of like take off, right?
If
he actually genuinely revolutionized public transport, if he was actually if he actually managed to build an underground train line with none of the, you know, sort of like disruption that you would get from any kind of like massive large scale development from somewhere like, you know, well, from California to New York, right across the country, and you could do that in a couple of hours. Like, yes, that would be
remarkable. Yeah,
that would be fantastic. And I think he wanted to do that, but I mean, it don't get me wrong. That's a gargantuan feat, right? Like, that's.
I think he's just a very sort of hyper masculine nerd, and hyper masculine nerds have ideas like that, but he's got the money to sort of almost get it going. Before people kind of realize, hang on, you don't actually have the technology for any of this, do you? It's like, no. Well, no, I thought you had that. You know? But you were bringing the technology.
Yeah. So what does it mean for...
Hang on, before the why he's bought it, I think he's absolutely 1,000,000% bought it for political power. I think he looked at 2016, looked at the impact that Facebook had on Brexit, Corbyn, actually. I think Corbyn benefited massively from Facebook and Trump. And that's been shut down since, like, you can't use Facebook like that anymore since Trump. and, you know, as I just kind of mentioned, I forget his name, Bezos bought the Washington Post. This is like almost like old school. What do you call it? They weren't billionaires back in the day, were they? The millionaires back in the day buying media outlets. I mean, I think we know how dangerous Rupert Murdoch is with his, you know, the press stuff that he. I mean, he owns a vast swathes of the world's press, and, you know, Sky News, Fox News, tons of newspapers, and that's incredible. That's been incredibly erosive to democracy and the world, really. And I think this is the modern version. You know, newspapers are nothing now. TV's dying. This is the new form of that. And I think it's going to be even more damaging and powerful than those things were. And I think he's bought Musk so that he can be the one who is in charge of the narrative when it comes to our limited democratic interventions.
Yeah. I mean, that's certainly, you know, like a lot, certainly logical. I can certainly, because I mean, it's the only like real, like, tangible reason you do it, because it's a money pit, right? Like, it doesn't make any kind of money. I personally doubt Twitter's impact, especially going forward, on political affairs.
I think it's meaningful that it was Facebook that swayed things and not Twitter, because I think, and you're probably going to go on. I think Twitter, I think journalists and politicians are all on Twitter talking to each other and thinking that everybody's listening.
That's exactly what it is. And I say that as a member of the media, you know, like, to me, Twitter does not seem like a particularly consequential platform. It also, and I got some mail in from our last podcast, actually, from a Zoomer who says that they don't even fathom to think about Facebook and Twitter. They're on TikTok, a little bit of YouTube, Discord.
I was going to say, is that because they're Fosse and they're on Fediverse? But no,
they're not Fosse at all. Telegram, you know, like a lot of these like group chats, like WhatsApp, Snapchat, that's really where the social media is these lot, you know, smaller communities of, you know, a dozen, half a dozen people. The idea of like speaking to the world, it's kind of not, it's kind of fading. TikTok definitely does that, but I don't know enough about TikTok to really comment on it.
Well, the thing is, TikTok is so bite-sized that I think different propositions. It's not discursive like Twitter pretends to be. It's not long form like YouTube is. So I think the potential to do democratic harm is probably less on TikTok. But no, I think it is interesting that it was because Facebook, you know, in 2016, we're deep into the period where Facebook is deeply unfashionable, right?
Mm.
Like, cool people weren't using Facebook, yet it was Facebook that was swaying elections, not just amongst older people, but also amongst, you know, fairly younger people. Mm. And it wasn't Twitter. And I think that speaks volumes.
Yeah. I mean, Twitter definitely seems to have gotten worse in the past year when it comes to, like, all kinds of things. Like a lot of TERFs are on Twitter. And
yeah.
The thing is, they don't have any kind of like persuasive, like they just come across as like a lot of people on Twitter who have like really strong opinions and are determined to use Twitter as this platform to change minds always seem to come across as like lunatics, right? Like it doesn't ever seem to me like I never see a tweet from someone goes, oh, that person agrees with me with some intelligent, rational points. I'd like to talk to them more about it. Not once has that ever happened.
You've never seen a tweet and been like, they make a really good case for fascism.
Yeah. To be honest, anything, you know, like including... it's just... it isn't as discursive. Discursive? It doesn't enable dialogue as well as it tries to. I don't think it's as influential as it tries to as well.
Well, I think it's... I was gonna just add on to what I said before. I think it's influential in that... I mean, have you watched BBC political reporting in the last, like, 5 years?
Yeah.
It's like Lisa Kunzberg talking about tweets.
Yeah.
That's... So it gets through to the mainstream media in that way, because, you know, it's on the BBC. Mm. And the BBC, like... newspapers will write stories about what politicians have tweeted, and then as soon as it's in the newspapers, the BBC can report it, and you've got that sort of feedback loop. As to whether that actually affects anything, I say yes and no. I would say not to the extent that people would think, and it's a tertiary effect by that point.
Yeah, I suppose so. And at that point, of course, anything could be replaced by Twitter. You know, like Twitter.
I think the important thing there is it's being filtered through the Murdoch press. That it's not what people are tweeting, it's what Murdoch is choosing of what people are tweeting. Murdoch is kind of the active damaging effect there.
Yeah. So are we on to what this is going to mean for Twitter though?
Yeah.
Like I say, it does seem like it's gotten worse lately, and I can't see Twitter. Like the trend that Twitter seems to be going down seems to be like the path of less reasonableness, right? Like it just seems to be getting a bit crazier and crazier, and I think that more and more like normal people are they're not necessarily leaving it. I just think they're just not choosing to
using it less,
to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
And I noticed, and this is a new thing as well, on my Twitter feed, in the notifications, it just gives me random trivia about who other people I know are following. It's like, oh, so-and-so. Yeah. It's not a notification.
Twitter's really had a problem, because I think the leadership of Twitter probably, they wanted to keep it they wanted to keep its reasonable appearance. They didn't want it to, you know, become like some websites have become just like, you know, a fascist cesspool. So they did want to sort of, you know, weed out those people. They were a bit horseshoe about it, you know, like far left and far right, both dangerous. But the problem is that, like, their whole algorithm is predicated on showing you stuff that makes you angry. So they can't go too far with that. Like, it's always going to be a hostile, horrible, toxic place, or you accept that you run it at a huge loss and make it pleasant.
I think Facebook is the worst for that. I remember sometimes, like, I'll visit a group or like whatever, and then I'll get targeted ads saying why this group is dangerous or this group aren't or dunking on this group. There's a lot of like dunk posting as well. And as someone that doesn't typically get enjoyment out of the downfall of others, I mean, don't get me wrong, we all enjoy it from time to time, but it's not something that I personally engage with. And when it comes up on my feed, especially if it's not like I didn't ask for it, it feels manipulative. Like,
yeah, it feels like
you're clearly showing this so that I get angry and click on it or comment on it or something like that. And I usually just block at that stage because I know exactly why they're there and doing exactly what they're trying to do. And when because with Facebook, I only use it for work. Like, it's strictly a work thing for me. So it's very easy to determine where something comes from because I only look at a few topics, a few, you know.
That's interesting, actually. Yeah, if somebody actually uses Facebook, you know, for themselves, for recreation or whatever, like, because they've looked at so many things on it, you can't tell where it's coming from, right? Which hides what it's doing a little bit. I think that's an interesting point.
Yeah, and it'll just bombard me with a lot of it as well. It seems to have worked out that, or it seems to think that I'm younger because I get a lot of posts saying young people don't know how to do this anymore, or young people don't, you know, like young people, they'll never understand how tough we had to be in the old days, or all this kind of stuff.
So it thinks you're old, right?
Oh, it might think I'm old. Actually,
kids today.
No, I get a lot of like kids today posts, so yeah, no, it probably does think I'm old then, maybe. But it is that one, yeah, like those things, and it's such low hanging fruit as well. It's not clever as something, you know. It's like, and it's sort of like, you know, these posts that make out that every person over the age of 50 has a cabin and they live in the woods and everything.
I mean fundamentally it is incredibly dangerous and just obviously such a bad idea to have billionaires who have very specific interests in control of, I mean, the thing is, we had it for centuries with newspapers and television channels, but it seems even more dangerous with these social networks, which can be so easily manipulated in a way that's invisible, I think, to most people.
Yeah.
And they can just, I'm sure you've seen since Bezos bought the Washington Post, like some of the headlines just sort of justifying the excesses of capitalism and stuff, and
it's just good king, bad king at the end of the day, right?
If there were such a thing as a socialist billionaire and they bought Twitter and they were going to use it, you know, as a socialist propaganda tool, like, I'd be for the outcome, but still, you know, just as worried about like that as a structural reality.
I would doubt the trajectory of that, to be honest.
I mean, it couldn't happen, so it's kind of like that,
take away like necessarily the inherently the socialist side of things and think more like grassroots and people and all that kind of thing, that's fundamentally what the Fediverse is, right?
Yeah.
Which, unsurprisingly, you do see quite a lot of socialists on the Fediverse, so, you know.
Yeah, I wonder why,
And
huge numbers of trans people, which, you know, because I don't speak for them, but my assumption is that they're escaping from horrible treatment on Twitter, you know.
Mm.
A place where they're not getting, you know, shit
and
all the time.
And also, I think a lot of benefits for any kind of marginalized group on Fediverse is that if this is contingent on knowing how the Fediverse works and knowing why the Fediverse exists, which is a barrier to entry, which not all groups have managed to sort of like get past, which is, you know, we could call it a fault of the Fedi or whatever, but those that have, when you work out how the Fediverse works, you can have your own server and then someone amongst you, you can find the resources to fund it and moderate it and protect your community from forces that lie outside.
And that's not to suggest it's necessarily completely insular. It's not, you can have that if you want that, but, you know, it's connected to other places that that you feel safe connecting to.
It allows any community
almost entirely private space where you can, you know, define yourselves and be yourselves.
Yeah.
It's the best of both kind of thing, right?
Exactly. It allows communities to engage with the world on their terms.
Mm.
And that's the important thing. It's not an Elon Musk telling you what's offensive or what's not. It's your community leaders. And again, you may not agree with them 10 times out of 10, but at least you probably agree with them more often than you agree with Elon Musk, right? And then if not, you can find communities or places that are suitable to you. It's not a foolproof outcome, but it is one where you have the agency to change the outcome, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Adopting the Fediverse isn't going to get rid of fascism overnight. It's not going to get rid of bigotry overnight. And it's highly naive and ridiculous to say that bigotry and fascism doesn't exist on the Fediverse in some of its corners. But there are defense mechanisms against it. So, for example, there are like heavily right-leaning instances, which on the whole have been pushed out to the side when it comes to like, you know, being sort of blocked en masse by other servers.
And even if they're not, you know, for anybody who's not familiar with Fediverse stuff, like you can just block that entire server, which is, you know, anytime I see anything remotely like alt-righty or whatever, I just block the entire server.
Yeah. And I think the key word there is agency, right? Like it gives you and your community the ability to sort of set its own place in the social media landscape, which I think is really kind of, you know, important, really. Mm. Also, a huge benefit of the Fedi when it comes to everything else is that it isn't run on advertising, which I think is kind of important.
Yeah.
Because And it's even though you have to pay for it like yourselves in terms of like the servers have to be paid for either by like Patreon donations or sometimes it's grant, like on the instance that I'm on, it's funded by grant funding. So you know there are all kinds of ways of and some people just have a Raspberry Pi in their bedroom, some people they're like server enthusiasts, so it's not much to them. So there are all kinds of ways of finding it, and some are sponsored, like by, you know, projects like Linode and other bigger companies out there. So you get, you know, you choose what's suitable for you, and also of course with Mastodon you get to migrate.
I mean, they could at some point, if it gets popular enough, there might be ad supported servers, but the point there is that you've got a choice. You know, yeah. If you're okay with advertising supported servers, then cool.
Yeah.
And they'd have to find a different way of doing it, for sure.
Yeah. So it seems like a lot of people have come to the Fediverse, either who have been and returned back to, you know, been and left, or some new people. But a lot of the people I see on my timeline, and it might just be my timeline being, you know, from a particular perspective, I see a lot of people returning after having left. Whenever there's like
a big... let's finish. What does it mean for Twitter, do you think?
Okay, what does it mean for Twitter? I think Twitter is a dead platform walking.
Yeah, sorry. I talked over you.
I think Twitter is almost a dead platform walking. Other than that news cycle thing that you said, where, like you say, with the BBC reporting, they pulled down a tweet, all that kind of stuff. Outside of that, I think it's just going to descend into worthlessness because, and the only people on it will be elected representatives of all stripes. You know, you get your councillors, MPs, all the rest. You'll get your media, and you'll probably get maybe a couple of businesses or what have you. But really, beyond that, and when I see some of the things that are trending, it seems to illustrate that like stuff's trending that not everyone's talking about. If that makes sense, right? Like genuinely stuff that you go out in the street and you have like small talk conversation with people, it's not the stuff that's trending on Twitter. So Twitter does not represent the normal public conversation. So I outside of that particular paradigm of the news cycle, I think Twitter's just, it's on its way out anyway. The Generation Z aren't interested in it. I think older people probably are more happy with Facebook. It's this it is like this awkward middle platform that I think people are going to drift away from it. I don't think it will be one thing like Elon Musk buying it that will cause an exodus. I don't think there will necessarily be an exodus. I think it will be waves. But
I think it will be waves, and I think it will be as it is. It's the toxicity that I think is going to push people. I think people just over time, all people will realize this is a horrible place to be that doesn't bring me any happiness whatsoever. It just brings me discomfort and sadness.
Yeah. I'm on Twitter. Like, I would say that I would probably have a Twitter account if it wasn't for my job. But in reality, it wouldn't be a pinned tab if, you know, like, it wasn't for my job. Like, I'd probably just naturally gravitate away from it. I wouldn't do it, you know, like, not out of any kind of principle. It's just a bit shit.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
No one I know tweets anymore, right? None of my friends actually tweet. Like, if I wanted a social media where, like, more of my friends TikTok than tweet nowadays. So
I think what Twitter is good for, it's a use I have no use for, but it is for celebrities to broadcast to their fans, right? And by celebrities, I'm including like politicians or whatever. Like, that's its purpose. It's a broadcast medium. It's a broadcast medium pretending to be discursive, right? And I've put a post up actually on the thingy, but I saw a post. Somebody coming from Twitter was asking, like, how do I use the Fediverse for essentially broadcasting to large numbers of people? And there's a good response, the one that I put up on screen, but essentially just saying that's not what the Fediverse is for, or not what it's good at. The Fediverse is for talking with a small group of people, not broadcasting to millions of people. And I think that's the point. A lot of what Twitter was said to be at the start, and what people go to it for, I think, is for conversations about interest. And they keep going there despite the fact that doesn't exist there, because they, somewhere in their brains, they believe that will be there if they try hard enough. Whereas, already, that is exactly what you find.
Exactly,
such an affirming way, like so many good conversations on the Fedi.
And interestingly enough, there's the old meme of, was it Mastodon is crumbling? Do you remember that old meme? It was like a New York Times article, or like like one of those like newspapery magazine-y articles that was like, the Fediverse is crumbling and here's why. And it basically made the point that that you can't use Mastodon and the Fediverse as this broadcast medium, you're not going to reach millions of followers or any of this kind of stuff. Therefore, it's dead. It's worthless. Don't even bother with it. And we all love to like have a chuckle. You know, like it's a bit of a meme where it's like, yeah, all right, we're still here after like 10 years. You know, I think the first network that you could describe as the Fediverse, using all of this kind of stuff and GNU Social and all that kind of stuff, it's 10 years old. You know, like none of this stuff is new. Like and the thing I do like about the Fediverse is that it sort of like expands and contracts naturally. Like it's a breathing, living organism in digital space. It's not always, you know, it's going to contract sometimes. It's going to grow. It'll just be what it is, and it doesn't matter. Like as long as it exists in one form or another, it's what I consider to be home, to be honest, because it just doesn't need to. I don't want my boss on Mastodon. Like, I don't want, you know, my family. Like, do you know what I mean? If they are, then that's great. And everyone I want on the platform, I want to be there because they want to be there, and they want, you know, like that's kind of fine, right? Like it to me, it's what, you know, like Twitter used to be when it was that slightly more peculiar discursive platform. That, you know, and it was obviously going to go this way because that's how capitalism kind of goes, right? Like, it's always got to go to the direction of make people money. If it's not making money, it's not valuable through the lens of capitalism. You can kind of twist it and turn it into say, well, you know, Twitter's potentially useful for political capital and therefore
politically relevant. Because Twitter, I don't think it still never made money, right? Or at least
still.
Yeah.
Never mind.
So there's two arguments. I think one of them is people have realized that it's a public good, even if it's not making money, it's useful, blah, blah. I mean, there are examples. The examples that are usually used to justify it is like the organizing of the, what was it called? The revolutions in the Arab countries over the...
Iranian...
The Iranian one, yeah. And I don't know to what extent that is true, it being used to, I have no reason to doubt it. I guess it must be used for organizing those things, but yeah, and I guess it is good for that, but the Fedi would be no worse for that, for sure, and in a lot of ways better. So maybe that is its one useful use, but that's such a rare thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I agree with you that while it doesn't make a profit, it acts in the interest of capital. That's fundamentally what its value is.
Yeah, and the Fediverse cannot do that. So I don't think the Fediverse can replace Twitter. I don't want to underwrite the entire premise of all of this, but they're not like for like comparisons.
No,
it's and the Fedi is kind of like, you need, like, in reality, you need to know how it works. Now, you don't necessarily need to know how it works on day one, but as you get exposed to it, as you get more sort of embedded into the culture of it all, you will work out like what servers mean. You'll have, you know, the good servers, the bad servers, the interesting servers, the boring servers, and that will sort of form over time. And that's all part of the organic nature of knowing how it works. And also, it's genuine, authentic, and it's organic, right? Like, it's not like the metaverse where everything seems to be like they want that, like it seems to be so full of this manufactured authenticity that it's surreal. They want it to be cool and kooky and fun, but also in this very controlled, very corporate friendly manner. You know, only
so glad for banal. It is the nightmare. I love going on Fedi, and since I got off Linux Rocks, which is a very Linuxy place, just on I'm on Mastodon.social now, which is the default one, which has been really slow today, which I assume is a lot of Twitter users joining, which I'm kind of happy about. You know, it's like, oh, it's slow, that's good. But no, I love just going on and see, you know, post about somebody resurrecting some old computer, and then somebody's quilt that they've made, and then a painting, and then somebody's like a music thing they've created, and then somebody like the comic that they're making. And I might not be interested in those things specifically, but that kind of that richness and diversity of just people doing stuff.
Yeah. My timeline very much is the same as well. I'm on toot.wales, which is quite nice. I'm a moderator on there, which is kind of interesting, because every now and then we'll get like spam accounts will start like hammering the server, and we'll try and sometimes we'll have to close the server to prevent the spam accounts like, you know, overwhelming us or that kind of stuff, which is all kind of like interesting in terms of how it works as well. But yeah, it's kind of nice. Toot.Wales is like slightly Wales specific, so you'll get like a local timeline, and that's kind of nice. You know, like I kind of like that there are people who I have never met before, but it's like, oh, you're only like 2 hours drive away, or you're only, you know, like you're sort of down the road, and it's kind of interesting. And I think it was originally created to keep sort of like Welsh people who live in other countries connected with Wales, and it's done a really good job of that, I feel, right? Because you've got a lot of Welsh people that live abroad, but you also got a lot of Welsh people that live at home, and that's kind of cool.
A lot of what he said, Musk talks about Twitter as the public, he keeps talking about the Agora and the public square, the town square, right? Which it just isn't. You know, in this post, the person says no one can have a conversation with 100,000 people. It isn't. Twitter is not the town square. It is a broadcast medium. Whereas how you're describing Toot.Wales, like the Fedi in general, and, you know, organizing around interests or locations or whatever you want, the people who are closest to you, you know, either in terms of interest or in terms of, you know, whatever you want, the people who are closest to you are closest to you on the Fedi as well. It reflects that, I don't want to say hierarchy, but like shells of, you know, you can venture further out and get, you know, get things that are a bit further away from you, or you can stay in your cozy little, you know, home and just, you know, look at old computers or whatever. It feels like, I don't want to say the town square, because I don't even like that idea particularly, but it's like a community, or it's not like a community, it's like it's like a world of communities that all can all connect to each other if and when they want to. And
so
that's
what Twitter never felt. So you'd say it's like a more, it's a more organic representation of the real world, almost.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Oh, yeah. In a way that like the closest thing was probably like way back in the early, not the early, the early, early days, but, you know, around about late 90s, early 2000s, you know, web forums organized around a specific interest. And that, you know, you had just your forum that you went to, and you'd never talk about the specific interest because you all just became friends over years, right?
Yeah.
We don't have anything like that anymore. Well, and it's like, it's that feeling, plus they're all connected together if and when you want them to be.
Yeah. I see some of that in Discord, where you've got, you know, where people have little sort of like, I feel like Discord has replaced the forum in certain ways.
I think a lot of things have replaced the forum, but I don't think they've regained, apart from Fedi, I don't think they've regained that feeling of genuine community. Discord, yes, but they're very disconnected.
Hmm. Oh, right. Yeah, so it's more... Yeah. I mean,
You don't meander from one Discord server to another, you know, when you're in the mood. It's somebody links it to you or you search for it, which is a different thing. On the Fedi, like, the further you explore, the further you get away from your interest and your location, and sometimes you're in the mood for that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And the thing is, I come back to it not out of any kind of, like, sense of duty to, like, free and open source software or nothing like that. I come back to it because it is actually interesting.
It's a
nice place to be.
Homely.
Like, yeah, because with Twitter, like you say, going back to this, like, the idea that it's not only it's a broadcast medium masquerading as a town square, but everyone sees through the masquerade. So you've got your like, for example, your anti-vax nutters. They want to like just use Twitter as a way to get their agenda across.
Everybody's gaming it.
And it's not, don't get me wrong, it's not just the nutters that are doing it, it's the people I agree with that are doing it as well.
So it's like walking into a room and everybody's like a New York grifter from like a 50s movie. Do you know what I mean? Like, where's the queen?
Yeah, yes, it's exactly that. Yes.
That's how it feels being on Twitter. Whereas, like, have you ever had an interaction on Fedi that wasn't nice?
If I have, I can't remember it.
Yeah, it's like everybody's... And this is because... I think it's partly because of the structure, but it's also the culture that's emerged from the structure and the kind of people who are there. I think it's a bunch of interrelated things, but there's a culture of being... Not nice in an insipid way, not like, oh, we're so wholesome, insipid vapidity, but like actual community niceness.
Yeah.
Generosity, kindness, you know, those things that are... Like, when's the last time you saw generosity or kindness on Twitter?
Exactly. I mean, and to be honest, my notifications now is pretty barren. Like, a lot of it is, okay, so I think the last conversation I had in Twitter that was, it was the last conversation I had, I think, and it was nice. It was with Alan Pope, and we were talking about something... techie, Linuxy, Ubuntu-y, I think. But beyond that, it's just like a list of people who have followed me and liked my tweets, and it's like, that's, you know, the engagement's not there. It's dying. It's dead. It's dead platform walking.
There's people I follow because they're interested in the same techie stuff as me. There's people I follow because they just do things that are interesting to me, even if I'm not inherent, like, you know, beekeepers, quilters, you know, people who make jewelry, like stuff that's interesting. There's the shit posters. the shit posters that I actually find funny, I follow them, and like all of those, even though I don't know them, I'm not in any communities with them outside of Fedi, like I can comment on anything that they say and be treated generously. Like, you know, I can say, that's a lovely quilt, like, how did you make it? Or, you know, the shit poster, if I think of something funny in response, I'll post it. And like, I'll get a few like boosts sometimes, and I'm like, oh, I said something funny. You know, it's just like you can engage with all these communities, and they're open to that. Whereas on Twitter, everything felt like closed. You know, if there was a specialist community, you didn't feel like you could you know, engage with that in any way at all. That was closed to you.
Mm. I'm also just reminded that Tommy Wiseau is on Mastodon. He tweets like once a year. He hasn't tweeted since 2020. Shameful.
How do you feel about mirrored tweets. What's the? It's not mirrored, is it? What's the term?
Bridged.
Bridged. Yeah.
Oh, it's very contextual, right? So if there's a Twitter account that is not pretending to be a person, right? So it's literally just maybe a news website or something of that type, and they bridge to Mastodon because they overtly want to use it as a broadcasting platform. They're not pretending to engage or anything like that. Yeah. I think that's on the whole fine.
No, I'm fine with that. Yeah,
it's that's fine. They're just there, right? Like, and you can block it, you can whatever. That's kind of fine. I suppose when people also like do it as people and they engage on both platforms meaningfully, I'm fine with that. The problem is, of course, that very rarely ever lasts, and then it usually defaults to you're just getting junk through a pipe from Twitter really at that point.
But if it's they post on both media and respond on both, fine. But if they're sort of referring to, if they're using @ to refer to people on Twitter when it's actually on Fedi, and that link, that, you know, that @ doesn't go anywhere because it's Twitter @. I don't want you here. Go away. Go back to Twitter. I kind of get sick of people talking about Twitter as well, referring to Twitter, and I make allowances now with the influx. You know, I'll give them a couple of weeks to settle down and stop comparing it to Twitter and all that kind of stuff. But like, I want Fedi to be Fedi. I don't want to hear about Twitter all the time.
Yeah, it's an entirely different culture, and people learn it over time, and that's all kind of cool. You got to put like embargoes or whatever on these kind of events. To allow people to settle in, but also someone once defined the success of a social media platform by when it stops talking about itself.
Mastodon's kind of got there, right? Fedi, whatever.
Yeah, and I talk about it a lot because I like talking about it a lot.
That's slightly different. Yeah, but the distinction is using Mastodon to talk about Mastodon.
But I'm looking at the federated timeline, and I see at the moment people are talking about a particular instance, a little bit of instance discussion. That's always going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a film, something about a film, something about Ukraine, something about a TV show. Oh, British politics trigger put in a content warning. Like buses with poppies on. So picture of a boat. The idea of calling yourself a free thinker. I thought that might have been a Twitter. That's something about Twitter, but I don't think so. Some memes. Mastodon art.
Mastodon art, that account is doing a great job of welcoming people, like, because artists escaping from Twitter are all going to Mastodon art, right? Is it mastodon.art?
That's the one,
she's doing a great job of sort of welcoming them and promoting them and celebrating their art. And it's not just like the really highly polished professional illustrator stuff. Some of it is quite amateurish, but in a nice way. Like, I want to see amateur art. I want to see people making art because they love making art and not just, you know, for a commission. She's doing a great job there. Yeah.
I've got an account on Mastodon art. That's where some of my photographs go up. I'm not hugely active. Like, I'll dip in there once every couple of weeks or so to either post something new, but also to like enjoy the instance as it is. Like, it's
got some great stuff on there.
But that's also one of the things I think is a good way to engage in the Fediverse, is like, it's okay to have like multiple accounts. Spread yourself about a bit, because that way if one of your instances disappears, then at least you've got a secondary.
And just for segregating your interests a bit, like I think that's a useful thing to do, you know, for your own mental well-being as much as just for like organization. But yeah, another thing she linked to was she made a little post about Take a breath. You're not on Twitter anymore. You're not competing for views now. You're talking to the converted. You can just make posts whenever you want. There's no pressure to make a post every day and please the algorithm and all of that. It's because it's nice. Yeah, you can just relax and make your art and show it to people when it's done.
Yeah, and having a non-algorithmic feed to me is it's a peace of mind.
Oh god, can I just go off on a slight tangent about how sick I'm fucking getting about when things aren't just temporal, temporally organized, chronological. Yeah, thanks. like YouTube, even the default page you land on when you click on the username of a YouTube channel.
Yeah,
and it's just the videos. I don't know what this order is. I want them in chronological fucking order, obviously. So I have to every single time I have to click on the username and then click on the videos tab that puts them in chronological order.
Yeah.
Who wants not that? Like, I know Twitter do it for algorithmic reasons and blah blah blah, but when it's on YouTube, what purpose does that serve? Put them in chronological order. It drives me fucking nuts.
Yeah. And especially when they're sort of presented as if they should be or as if they were. So it takes you longer than it should to find out, for sure.
That things moving around when I'm trying to use them are my current two biggest first world peeves. Netflix, right? When I'm scrolling down the list of stuff you can watch on Netflix, if you just happen to hover your mouse over something, it blows up and covers all the other stuff you're actually looking at. Because it's like they designed it for phones and touch screens, and then there's a web interface, but they didn't think about the fact that the web interface works different. And the auto-playing video at the top, I've stopped that from happening. But Steam does it as well now. But this, because I'm not necessarily pointing at the thing I want to look at. I'm just scrolling my mouse, and just wherever it happens to lie, that thing blows up and covers everything else. And every time it just irritates me so much. Yeah.
And also, it makes this assumption that, and you see it in more and more places nowadays, but it makes this assumption that video is the easiest way to, for everyone, it's the most accessible way to take on board content. But I'm not like that. If I'm watching a film, I want to read the blurb, right? It's with me, particularly with sports, a lot of people, I'm out of step with a lot of people when it comes to sports. I always much prefer reading it after the fact than ever watching it myself. If I'm watching it with other people, it's a bit more social, this kind of thing. And to be fair, that only rugby, everything else is just, but other than that, I like to reading about it is it's fine, because you just take a minute and then you've got all the information you need and all and you're there. Sort of similar thing with a film. I like the idea of I'll probably watch a film trailer before watching the film, not always though, but the fact that it's oh, you've hovered on this film for a little while. Is it forced engagement? Or is it literally
just talking about the auto-playing videos. I'm talking about you get the expanded information box that covers, I was actually looking at the thing slightly to the left and now it's covered up.
Yeah. Oh, that's, yeah.
It just drives me absolutely nuts. I know it's such a small thing, but it bundles into this, the big fat web that we've got now, instead of the, I'm quite capable, if I'm interested on something, of clicking on it and then going back.
Yeah. And the stuff that moves when we all know that feeling of you go to push a button on a website on a phone and then something moves down.
Oh, something loads and it.
Yeah. That's the
Steam. I actually use, the Steam discovery queue.
Yeah.
I use that quite frequently because, I'm always on the lookout for games. And they've got that section of if the dev is streaming the game or if anybody's streaming the game, which is never actually a live stream because nobody uses it. All it is a looping video made by the devs, right? But that loads in significantly after the rest of the page. So I'm clicking next, 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 and then it jumps down and I click on the video and a new thing opens and it's where was I? It's such a small thing again. I know it's petty, but it's just think about what you're doing. what happened to design?
Yeah.
Meaning making things work well.
Yeah. But actually, bringing it back to the Fediverse, one of the things I do quite like about it is that you do have the ability to sort of engage with it on countless apps and Even on the desktop as well. Like, there are desktop. I don't entirely necessarily see the point of desktop apps. Maybe if you're doing a business account or something, I don't know. But
app that made use of being a desktop app rather than just being a web app, then I could see a use for that. And, you know, almost, I don't know how, you know, I'm not going to design it in my head right now, it'd be pointless, but, you know, that works significantly differently in a way that the web couldn't. Then I could see. I actually tried a TUI Mastodon app the other day, Mediverse app the other day, and it was pretty cool. I don't think I'd use it because I've always got a browser open. I don't see why I would. But yeah, pretty cool. Cool thing. Cool that you can do that.
Yeah. Also, of course, with the Fediverse stuff, everything comes with an RSS feed. If you want to like find this is one of the things that I hope Elon Musk actually like comes through with on Twitter. I highly doubt it. I think this is yet another Elon check that he can't cash, but he did talk about the idea of making Twitter into a protocol, of open sourcing it, of possibly, you know, like generally just like talking a little bit more about opening it up into the world as a, you know, that kind of thing. And if that means putting RSS feeds onto Twitter feeds, that would be quite interesting and would be a step in the right direction, I think. Because there are plenty of...
While that would be a step in the right direction, I think that could actually be quite dangerous if Twitter became a protocol, maybe not that far, but if Twitter had some of the features of Fediverse, then it's competing with Fediverse. I could see that, you know,
sucking up
a lot of the air.
Do you think it would be competing with the Fediverse? What would the
not just with the RSS, but if they start doing activity pub stuff, like basically if they make a proprietary activity pub, because he said that he wants to make Twitter like WeChat in China, right? Which is somewhat like Facebook, it's a metaversey type thing. It's the idea is it's a service that you never leave. It does everything that you want. And if he's successful in that, that could be incredibly dangerous.
I don't want these to be my famous last words, but that feels highly unlikely.
I agree, but I do feel a bit famous last wordsy with it. You know, if he wants Twitter to be TikTok and YouTube and Facebook and like all in one, and you know, Snapchat and WhatsApp and I mean, it's not inconceivable.
And we do know that they know that the Fediverse exists. I think they have referenced to it in documents before. We have come up in their research. There is almost certainly a Elon Musk account in the Fediverse somewhere.
I bet there's code on the Twitter servers that plug into ActivityPub. I bet somebody's toyed with that idea.
Well, actually, funnily enough, there was Tumblr of all places. We're on the lookout for ActivityPub knowledgeable developer.
Well,
they put it out as a paid position, so it would be interesting to see. So, what would that mean if Tumblr joined the Fediverse? I imagine there would be a substantial number of instances that would just be like block.
And I think I feel that way myself while also thinking that's pretty cool.
Do you want corporate run
I feel about that. I think I'm more okay with it because they're kind of an underdog at this point, right? If Twitter went ActivityPub, that would scare the shit out of me because they could just
right. I've got to remember how do I have a Tumblr account? I don't. Okay, I must have deleted it at some point. I know a few people on Twitter, on Tumblr, and it's fundamentally like seems to be like rolling along in its own little way, but distilled into what it all was always meant to be, which was getting really, really into like certain TV shows. Where people you'd get the most hardcore of fans about. There's some of the like with the new Game of Thrones show, House of the Dragon. There's a lot of people like really like tearing that apart on Tumblr and all that kind of stuff. I think like it's probably one of the nerdier platforms. I think out of all of them, I think I can live with Tumblr.
Yeah. I think that's how I feel, because it is such a weird. It's such a weird. I think as soon as that, you know, when they got rid of the porn, and everybody says like this is the death of Tumblr, and in terms of the mainstream, it was right. But people who stuck with it were the absolute whack job weirdos. And I mean that in a loving way, right? Yeah. The wonderful weirdos with their weird communities, and I'll be okay. I'll be okay with linking up with them.
And also, they are owned by not the worst company in the world. Not
who are they owned by?
Automatics.
Who's that?
They own WordPress.
Okay. That kind of makes sense then.
Yeah, it was owned by
WordPress went ActivityPub.
There is a like a well known add on for WordPress plugs into ActivityPub. So I don't know. Yeah, I don't know who develops the plugin for it, but it's one that quite a few people I've seen use. So it used to be owned by Yahoo, and then Yahoo got rid of it when they realized.
Yahoo was the last one I knew was owning.
Yahoo was the one that broke it, and then they sold it.
Broke it and moved on.
Hang on a minute, I got to check, right? Because this is kind of funny. I want to know how much money Yahoo lost on Tumblr. So this is from Washington Post, titled "Tumblr once sold for $1.1 billion." That's not very much nowadays. The owner of WordPress just bought the site for a fraction of that. Oh my God! Report $3 million. Tumblr was sold. I'd have bought it for $3 million. Oh my God!
That's a bargain. That's probably well worth $3 million.
Well, it depends. How much does it cost to run? I mean, they could go the Snapchat route and have everything that after a certain period just gets deleted.
Yeah, I don't think they'd lose much from that, because it gets archived on Pinterest and 99Gag. Like the good ones get screenshotted and shared everywhere. I just put that. You know that post that you retweeted earlier? Can't wait for Fedi to become an integral part of the Tumblr to Reddit to Twitter to Facebook to Instagram repost pipeline.
Yeah.
But I put that up because I thought that was great. And that kind of fits in with that.
Yeah. I to be fair, I love Fediverse memes. They are, to me, just... I don't know. They're a little bit more witty than other memes. They're a little bit more
cut. I think I like, because I've got a second browser for the stream, right? I've not been doing much with it, and I apologize for that. I'll get better at that. But I put up a post by Anjune, which I enjoyed earlier today, and I put up that post that I just talked about. And part of what I love is like every when you actually go to the post individually on its own server, every server just looks completely different. Like they're all just, they are genuinely different places, right? I mean, a lot of them are the default Mastodon thing. But this one, I don't know what it is. Is it Pleroma or... I don't know. And that doesn't do anything. It looks cool.
I like... There is a Mastodon instance called Alipo Social, where it's just like a normal Mastodon instance, except you're not allowed to use the letter E.
Oh, yeah. I spent a Sunday afternoon reading through that and just looking like all these... Because it's just people posting... It's not like the letter E is deleted from all the words. They're posting without using words with E in them, and yet still communicating, and it's kind of amazing.
I like that. My name on it, my username, is Chris Was. So
I think an alarm was set up in response as well that was only a letter E's.
I think Dolphin Social, is it? Yeah. It's like the Alice in Wonderland of social networks, really, isn't it?
It's great. This is what happens when this is the difference between the old internet or the small internet or Fediverse, all of the things that are actually run by people versus these sanitized, awful corporate run spaces. Like you just don't get stuff. Humans are just monkeys that got too clever.
I have 208 followers on that account, Chris Wall. 208 people want to hear me not use the letter.
That's almost as many I've got on my main account.
It's great. I love it.
That's another thing, like, for people who are not familiar with Fedi, like, your number of followers just doesn't matter.
No.
because everything's just chronological. It, you know, if you're federated with it, you'll see it. You're not competing. You're not limited by how many followers you've got.
In fact, one of the things, whenever I get a response, I always check out the profile to see if they follow me.
And other things
that they post. And it's like, it's a 50-50 shot as to whether or not they follow me, as to whether or not they reply to anything.
Same for me, yeah.
So it's the discoverability on this is actually genuinely really good. And a lot of the time, if I'm having a solid conversation with someone, I'll just follow them anyway, because why not? I follow a lot of people.
Something I learned today, you know, because there's been a lot of, like, if you're new to Fedi type posts, one of the things I learned that was that you can't, if you search for, like, just a keyword, it won't search cross-instance, but hashtags will. So
yes,
we should use hashtags when we post about this podcast.
Absolutely. The reason for that is to prevent trolls and harassment.
Okay.
So, because you're on Twitter, a lot of times you'll find people will, like, they'll use alternative spellings to words, or they'll put like dollar signs where S's should be, or things like that.
Right.
And the reason for that is because there are people that sort of
just search through certain keywords and then go and bully people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the idea, particularly in Mastodon, I don't think this necessarily applies to, like, non-Mastodon Fediverse software, or, you know, your mileage may sort of vary in terms of that kind of thing. But the design is that only things that want to be found can be found.
That's great. That's great.
In that sort of way, right? Like, it's more, like, obviously, when you post something into the federated timeline, it goes into the chronological order. So it's not like all the targets are in one place, as it were. The targets for harassment, that is. But also, there are great controls on how visible something is. So you know, you've got public, unlisted, followers only, or mentioned people only. So,
Do we have a word for the Twitter-like part of the Fediverse? Because I always default to Mastodon, which is not accurate. It's not the Fediverse as a whole includes, like, Pixel Fed. And the video one. I'm so
PeerTube. This is the one we're on.
PeerTube, yeah, Pixel Fed, and all of the social media ones. What's do we have a word for the whatever this is?
I don't think we do, and I think this is a kind of a problem. So we've got Diaspora, Mastodon, PeerTube, GNU Social, Funkwhale, Friendica, Pixel Fed, Plerima, Hubzilla, Miskey. Is there more? I feel like I'm...
Say WordPress.
Oh.
Say Tumblr in the future.
/ WordPress Tumblr. There's also in the works a TikTok type one, which is going to be called Goldfish, which does exist, but is not yet federating. But that one is going to be... Yeah, because I kind of like this. On my main Mastodon account, I have a few short videos... Because I was trying out, like, if Twitter went away tomorrow, right? Not Twitter, YouTube now.
Yeah.
I always do this little thought exercise. What happens if YouTube goes away tomorrow? What do I do? Do I do something audio only and go a bit podcasty? Probably quite likely. Is PeerTube enough? Or if I make my videos small enough and short enough, I could probably get away with them on Mastodon. Providing it doesn't, like, overwhelm servers, which always is something that I try and think about when it comes to that kind of thing. So what I do on my Mastodon is that anything after 30 days, I think it's 30 days, gets deleted. So I don't feel too guilty about putting a video up on Mastodon, because in 30 days' time, that space can then be used for something else, and that's all fine. And it's not terrible. Like, it's not a terrible thing. Like, I do appreciate, despite that these podcasts we do are going to be long and sprawling and sporadic and all that kind of stuff, I am a big fan of brevity. I think, speaking as someone that writes news articles, I really do cringe a little bit when I see, like, online articles be like six times as long as they need to be. Brevity is the soul of wit. When I write, I have to write.
Oh, the reason for that is so they can slot in the right number of adverts, right?
Well, yeah, exactly, right. But, like, with press, right, it's 350 words. You know, we've got.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that's the right amount of space. We've got a certain amount for advertising, certain amount for picture, all that kind of stuff. But the 350 words, like, I've had to brutally cut down pieces to get there. And it's made a better article for it. There's a lot of stuff. Because the thing is, as well, people aren't going to really read much beyond 350 words. So you want to get, you know, you want to impart the information that counts. Online writing just takes liberties, and it's worse for it. I'm sure there was a point to that.
You're talking about server space and
yeah. So with Mastodon, keeping my videos, I try and keep them to my hard limit is 3 minutes. But I try and keep them to 1 minute, and I try and have them 480 by 480, so a square 480 by 480 pixel box. I find that's the one that works the best, right? It looks all right on mobile. It is fine in a window on desktop. You know, it's not important enough that you're going to want to watch it full screen. That to me is like the nice happy middle ground, and I could probably get a video down to less than 20 megabytes.
Isn't it just nice, though, that there's this social responsibility, like... The nature of the platform encourages you to think about this kind of stuff in a way that, you know, Facebook and YouTube and Twitter, like, they actively don't want you to think that way. They want you to think like this, you know, it's an endless pipe. But secondly, like, that links into, like, you know, climate change stuff. Like, we live in these environments that don't want us to be responsible. They want us to feel like, you know, we can do this. I'm not saying it very well, but you know what I mean?
They're obfuscating scarcity.
Yeah.
It reminds me a little bit of the early days of nuclear when they say before long electricity is going to be too cheap to meter, and it's a little bit like, you know, bandwidth will be too cheap to meter and all this kind of stuff. And it's because it's only in their interests to suck people into that mindset, because it stops up and comers, it stops new people entering the arena, right? If YouTube at this point has like the world of video on it now.
Mm-hmm.
There is no video platform that can wholesale replace it, because because what company can just say, all right, here's an unlimited amount of bandwidth, videos. It's not bandwidth, storage of 4K or maybe even more by now. Who knows what they're up to?
It's absolutely insane. Yeah.
And TikTok has done the best. They've taken the biggest bite out of YouTube that I think any company could realistically do, and they've done that by not being YouTube. And also, you could kind of say maybe Twitch has taken a bite out of YouTube.
I think honestly, I don't think they've taken a bite out of YouTube. I think they've done what you should do, which is present an alternative idea of what video can be. I don't think the kind of stuff that people watch on Twitch, TikTok. Particularly used to exist on YouTube. Same with, you know, it was Vine before TikTok, right?
But Vine was more that when
Twitch emerged, YouTube was like, oh, we could do that as well. And, you know, these companies feel like they're losing people to that, but these things can exist in parallel. Time on TikTok. I mean, this is part of what we're talking about with the scarcity thing. I think YouTube likes to imagine that YouTube users spend 24 hours a day on YouTube.
Yeah.
Which of course they don't. You know, they do other things, and some of that will be TikTok, and some of that will be Twitch. And but their goal obviously is to get you using YouTube 24 hours a day. That's you know in their stupid capitalist heads, that's the end goal, because that's maximum.
Watch time is the metric by which all things matter in YouTube. So any time that you're on another platform is time not on YouTube.
And this goes deeply economic. You know, with the way the economy is currently since 2008, really, and the quantitative easing, you know, which is essentially government buying its own bonds and making credit very cheap. Credit's very cheap in an environment when nobody's innovating. So what do companies do? They buy other corporate bonds, or they buy other companies, and often just competitors to shut them down. This is the environment we've encouraged. Is an environment where big companies buy their competitors and shut them down. And often, as in the case with like YouTube and TikTok, not that YouTube has bought TikTok, but like I don't think they are competitors. They can exist together. So there's been a destruction of many things that could have existed together.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, every time there's someone watching a TikTok that is not watching YouTube, that is a bite out of YouTube, right?
But it's kind of like the piracy thing, you know, everybody who pirates a game, the assumption that they would have bought that game. Just because if they weren't watching TikTok, maybe they would have been gardening. you don't know what they took time out of to TikTok. And the assumption that it was YouTube is the nonsense, I think.
Mm. Yeah, for sure, I guess. But, well, Yeah.
My broad point is just that this whole environment is bad. I was going to come up with a better word, but it's just bad. Whereas Fediverse is never going to be like, you know, oh, we're worried about Mastodon because somebody's making a Fediverse TikTok. Like that, you know, or it's competition. They're not even thinking that way, and that's great. That's lovely.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do look.
They would celebrate it. They would promote it. They would show it off.
Yeah. Well, that's another way you can
engage with people.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's no benefit to one company, person, or anything buying up other things because let's say, for example, I mean, I think Fediverse can at this stage at its time, it's a little bit, but in a fun way, reactive, right? So, like, you know, PixelFed's reacting to Instagram, Goldfish is reacting to TikTok, Mastodon and Plarima are kind of reacting to Twitter in very superficial ways, mind you, right? Like the actual culture of the Fediverse remains its own thing, but in terms of UI and paradigms, and I don't think
the idea that I know you weren't saying that it was, but I don't think the idea that, you know, we don't innovate or we don't come up with these ideas is shameful. You know, FOSS has been like that for at least that's been part of FOSS culture. You know, Linux is a clone of Unix, right? It's a clone of Unix. There are so many things, and every basic Unix tool is a clone of something that already existed. We're just we're taking things and making them free for people. There's no shame in that whatsoever.
Not at all. But it would be interesting to see if at any time in the future there is like a spark of innovation for something a bit new. Because the thing is, if it links into the activity pub, then it's already got a user base.
I think the fact that like on Fediverse, this is hard to conceptualize, especially in a way that is clear for new people. But on Fediverse, because, you know, let's call them like clones. So there's the Fediverse Twitter clone, there's the Fediverse Tumblr clone, there's a Fediverse, I'm not sure they're a Tumblr. What's PixelFed proprietary?
Instagram.
There's Instagram clone, TikTok clone, YouTube, you know, whatever. But they all talk to each other using the same language.
Yeah.
I think there's so much scope for innovation within those connections, not necessarily in the portals as such, but in the connections between all those things and the use that you can make of that. I think that's where the innovation will come later on.
Yeah.
But I think you've got to get all those things established first.
Yeah, for sure. I do wonder if there will be like a very sort of Silicon Valley startup type of thing that has like an idea for a very for-profit social media company and then piggy and links into ActivityPub and the Fediverse just so they've got a standing user base. And I can see that happening.
Oh, that will definitely happen. As Twitter loses users and Fedi gains them. I mean, not to imagine that everybody who leaves Twitter will come to Fedi. I think a lot of them will just leave Twitter and that's fine. But Fedi is certainly growing. And when it gets to the point where Silicon Valley notices it, they will see it as a thing that they can come and colonize, essentially, right?
Yeah. But I think there is an anti-colonial sentiment in the Fediverse, right? I think there will be defense mechanisms that actually this has happened. Do you remember Hive? Happened for like a day.
No, what was
Hive
that?
Day. So Hive Day is great. I wish I remembered the actual date of it and we could celebrate it like a festival, right? But there's this company called Hive that basically ripped off Mastodon code. They tried to like dumb it all down, make a social media sort of Twitter clone. It linked into the Fediverse, but it didn't really like allow you to explore the Fediverse. So it was like a very locked down Mastodon instance with its own theme and all this kind of stuff. And we basically laughed it off the Fediverse in a day. Like it lasted literally about a day, and loads of big instances blocked it because it wasn't abiding by the AGPL, because they just literally lifted the code. And everyone was like, "You're clearly just trying to do a cash grab in on the Fed. What are you doing?"
Comes when some Silicon Valley boffin comes up with a way to use Fediverse that is useful to the Fediverse users, that's when it becomes dangerous, I think. When it's not just a repainted Mastodon that's closed and, you know, it's just a cheap way of making a Twitter clone, right? When they do
By the way, if anyone listening remembers Hive Day, can, like, knows the date or has any kind of like archival of the date or like receipts,
it's not really comparable, but when Will Wheaton joined Fediverse?
Yeah.
Which I have mixed feelings about it, because I think Will Wheaton is probably a genuinely nice person. Seems to be. Yeah. But yeah, as a celebrity joining Fediverse, joining Mastodon, he just got harangued off the platform.
He did, yeah.
I'm proud and pleased with the sentiment of, like, we don't want these, like, broadcast, these celebrities who think of these things as broadcast platforms. We don't want those people. I don't want those people. I hope most Fediverse users don't want those people. I'm not really quite sure Will Wheaton is that. I think he does actually engage.
He runs Debian at home. Like I think out of all the celebrities, I think he was a fit. The reason he got chased off was because he used a block list that was transphobic.
I think that was a pretext, honestly. Because I don't want to speak for the trans community and they can absolutely correct me, but I think it was understood that it was an honest mistake and they were just using it. And it was that was used as a pretext. Maybe not, but that's how it felt to me.
Possibly. Yeah.
I mean, do you believe for a second that, again, we're two white heterosexual cis men, but do you believe for a second that Will Wheaton is transphobic at all?
No, I don't think he's transphobic. No. I think that was I think it was a genuine mistake.
Yeah.
But yeah, so maybe it could have been a pretext. But then, like you say, would I know? I don't know the guy from Adam, but I doubt it. Like he doesn't seem. I don't know.
I mean, he's a through and through liberal, which.
But Tommy Wiseau is on Mastodon.
Tommy Wiseau is not a celebrity.
I don't know if Tommy Wiseau even has an ideology.
I'm not even sure Tommy Wiseau has a functioning. You know, I don't know.
I don't know. To be fair, he toots once a year. So if you're a celebrity that toots once a year and then just listens, probably fine.
yeah. I mean, I'm sure Will Wheaton would have been fine on the Fediverse. Like you say, of all the celebrities, he's probably the best fit. But I like the hard line at the same time.
I mean, the thing is, though, it was like the antibodies of the Fediverse sort of kicked in, right?
Yeah,
I think I probably would have. Assuming that he's not transphobic, I would have preferred him to have stayed. But, like you say, it might have been like there could very well have been people that thought, oh, he might make it mainstream and he might bring in people. He might like colonize it as such. It might just be the fact that people just don't know how to interact with a celebrity when they're not in that paradigm, when they're not.
Yeah,
Because the Fediverse does not really suit parasocial relationships that
no.
well. So it's like, oh, you've got a famous person, and then you've got who walk amongst us. It's like what would happen if, like, you know, Tom Cruise would just walk the streets, right? He'd get mobbed and like killed.
I don't know. Right? I think this is the thing. I think this is with Fediverse. I think it's more like, what if Tom Cruise like walked into my room and put my kettle on and sat down on my bed and started, you know, like I'd be like, piss off, Tom Cruise. Get out of my house. I mean, Will Wheaton's not the biggest celebrity in the world, for sure, right? He's cultivated this nerd. You know, he's known amongst nerds, I guess, is the thing. But he would have got an enormous number of followers. I imagine he would have been the most followed person on the Fediverse. And I think that very quickly... perverts is probably too strong, but as soon as you, because we don't have anybody like that, right? Even the people who made Fediverse don't have that many followers, right? You know what I mean?
I'm going to look at Eugen and see how many followers he's got. But where is he?
10,000 maybe?
He's got hundreds of thousands.
Oh, is he really? Okay. But it's certainly not millions, right?
Social.
How many? How many's Will Wheaton got on Twitter? Is he on Twitter? How do you spell Will Wheaton? There he is. He's got 2.7 million followers.
So Eugen's got 128,000 followers.
Okay, that's actually a lot. Maybe it's not as big a pronounced difference as I would imagine then.
I don't know. Is it even possible to measure? Because the thing is, as well, is like the follower count, I imagine, is not really that useful.
That's
because
true, yeah.
How many people are active users, or that kind of stuff? Also, if you're an administrator of an instance, you get like you might be more, you're likely to be more followed. Some instances will auto follow the admins so that you have a point of contact.
Very, very MySpacey, that.
That is,
that'd be the other way around, right? If they automatically followed you, but we should also emphasize follower count isn't what matters on the Fedi. Like, again, it's your reach is not determined by your follower count. But yeah, I don't know. I think as soon as you've got one of those kind of parasocial triangle relationship type people on Fedi, I don't know.
That's all it takes. All it takes is one.
I don't even know what I mean by all it takes. It's not like all his celebrity friends would go like, oh, Fedi worked out for you, I'm going to join Fedi. I'm not sure what I'm imagining the mechanism would be, really. But it just changes. It means there's an example of something I don't like on the place, I guess. And
so it almost legitimizes it as the broadcast medium you don't want it to be.
Yeah, maybe it's that.
I don't know. I don't...
Could we just have a server where all the celebrities go? And then you can just block it if you want to. I mean, that's kind of ideal, right? All the people who want to use it in that broadcasty way get to if they want, you know, and all the people who want to listen can listen.
See, that's the thing. Like, I mean, it would, like, in an ideal world, it seems like, right, you could get maybe a business, and their job as a business is to host a Mastodon server and allow other businesses to use this server, maybe for some kind of rental price or whatever. It'd be moderated and all that kind of stuff, right? And all the businesses could just have a space on this server, and then, you know, like, sort of like business hosting, but in the Fediverse.
So,
but
hang on, are you just saying like there'd be one server disconnected from the rest of the Fediverse with just all of the businesses on it just talking to each other? Because I would love that. I mean, all businesses and bots. So the businesses think somebody's listening to them, so everybody's happy.
Well, I'm thinking of bots in space, which is actually
a billion-dollar idea. I think we should go to Silicon Valley and see if we can get funding for that.
Yeah, for sure. There's, do you know Tom Scott on YouTube?
Yeah.
He did a sort of a jokey video where he started a social network where you could only use emojis. And he got an offer on that. I don't think he took it in the end, but he.
I used to kind of enjoy Tom Scott's videos now and then. I never subscribed or anything, but when they popped up on my thingy, I'd go, yeah. But I watched a talk he gave at where's the place where boffins go to give a talk?
TED Talk.
No, like full on boffins, not 10 boffins.
Oh, MIT or is it like
British London? Royal Academy.
Yeah, they do talk.
Yeah, Royal Academy. If that's the right. Yeah, he was giving a talk at the Royal Academy, I think. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was going to be, because it's at the Royal Academy, I thought it was going to be about science and about popular science and, you know, the way he engages. The entire talk was like about his strategy for making money on YouTube. Which just revealed to me how much of a business he sees. Like, and that just kind of ruined it for me. I know it doesn't change the content of his videos, but it just ruined it for me. That when somebody just sees it that much and that ruthlessly and that kind of single-mindedly as a business, as a, you know, I made this decision because this made more money. You know, I preferred this format, but it wasn't making as much money, so I did this instead. Those kind of decisions, I'm like, I just find that very distasteful.
It is, but like, I'm looking at my subscription feed now, and that's like, that's what a lot of YouTube is now. You know, those are the people that stay.
Part of YouTube I'm interested in though, and I don't watch that stuff mostly. You know, with exceptions, of course. But I like the amateur stuff. I like the small stuff. I like the people who are doing it just because they like doing it. I like the amateurish videos with the shitty audio, you know.
I do, but I can't find those anymore. Do they still exist?
Yeah.
I need more recommendations.
Mine are very niche though, because it's usually people playing like roguelike games and stuff.
There's quite a few, like they're not big creators, but they definitely have a schedule. YouTube's their job type of thing, you know. So they.
I'm okay with that. As long as they'd be doing what they're doing, even if it weren't making money. I think that's kind of the litmus for me. And they'd be doing it in the same way.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I demonetized my YouTube because I don't think that's a paradigm that can exist. I think once you start making money, you start seeing it through the lens of capitalism, I guess. And I think that's arguably why YouTube are so keen to give people these partnership programs, even if they only pay out pennies a month.
I'm getting to the point where, like, if I'm searching, like, often it's like I want to know what a game I'm interested in looks like to play, right? So I, you know, search for the game on YouTube, and I will weed out or just mentally filter the ones that have more than 10,000 subs. I'll be like, that's not interesting to me. They're going to be of a particular character. I don't mean the people. I mean the content is going to have a particular character, and I just go for the ones with, you know, like, yeah, anywhere from 100 subs to, you know, 8,000 subs. I'm like, yeah, that's the one I'm interested in. Some of them are terrible, so I move on to the next one. But you know, yeah, that's the area of YouTube I kind of live in.
I would love to live there. I guess I've neglected to seek out like interesting.
I mean, you've got people, a job and stuff. You're busier than I am. I have time to weed through it.
Yeah, I mean, I like things like Big. Do you know BigClive.com? That's
no.
Oh wow, actually, that's 100,000 subscribers. Oh, that. is that
well over my threshold. Although I'll tell you what I spent yesterday doing on YouTube. I rewatched the live Brexit vote coverage, which 10 hours and 40 minutes.
Oh wow! Okay, what did you? Yeah. What?
I watch it every now and then. I also rewatch election coverage. From historical elections, the live coverage, and US presidential, and I was watching the Republican debates from 2016, where Trump was, you know, first.
Yeah. I mean, they were entertaining.
They were. I said this at the time, and I said, I probably said it to you, so you know I'm not bullshitting. The first moment of that first debate, I was like, Trump's going to win. I didn't get the nomination. I wasn't talking about the election, but like, you just saw it. Like, he's going to win. These kind of people are going to love this. Because the very first question, we shouldn't go too long on this, but the very first question on the very first debate with Trump was, and this is obviously tailored for Trump. The questioner said, raise your hands if you're not willing to make the commitment that if you don't get the Republican nomination, you won't run as a third party. And he put his hands up and said, if I don't get the nomination, I'll run as a third party. And, you know, the whole auditorium booed. And I was like, he's going to win this. Like, they're going to, the kind of people who he needs to vote for him are going to love that.
Yeah. And to be fair, when I was 14, I got like my first political sort of like thing that got me mobilized was the war in Iraq.
And really? Right.
That was under Bush.
Yeah.
So watching him like tear apart Jeb Bush, it was a weird sort of catharsis for me. And then Trump had a falling out with was it Elon Musk on Twitter not too long ago. He had a falling out with someone that I like. Two people are fighting that I don't like. And I think it was I think Trump and Elon Musk did have a falling out on Twitter. And I was like, and it was like, that's why people love Trump, right? It's because he, like, when he goes after someone you don't like, it's very cathartic to watch. It's like
there's a line in the second debate where Rand Paul was criticizing Trump for making fun of people's appearances, and Trump says back, I don't remember it verbatim, but Trump says back to him, "I've never made fun out of your appearance though." And believe me, there's a lot of ammunition there. Just, not the thing. I mean, that first one that I was talking about, you just don't say that. Like, that's his value, right? It's like, you're breaking all of the rules, and people love that.
Yeah, it's...
Because it reads as straight talking.
And then there was that one debate that he didn't show up to, and it was so boring.
Oh, yeah. And they'd weeded out all the interesting ones by then as well, right? All the mad ones.
Oh, I do love a good Republican primary. They're
so much more interesting to watch than the Democrats.
Yeah. Democrats...
Somebody, you know, relatively interesting, like Sanders. You know, Sanders is a firebrand as far as the Democrats are concerned, but, like, the debates were so dull.
Yeah, and a lot of the Democratic primaries was like... You could almost see the cogs going in the head of what's the line to take that's the most like will get me as furthest in the race, right? They want to sort of straddle the, I want to be like left enough to appeal to the younger vote, but at the same time, I don't want to alienate the party donors, so I'm going to be like...
Military or...
Yeah.
Especially with Hillary.
Yeah.
No, and also in the Republican ones, because they get audience questions. I think the questions came in via Facebook and were vetted beforehand, obviously. And one of the questions in the first debate was, again, I can't remember the wording, but it was, you know, this is Ron in Texas, whatever. Have you spoken to God today? And what did he say? Can you imagine that in a British, like, political, like, people for prime minister being asked, like, what did God say to you today? And you know, because they're Republicans, and they've got to appease this crazy Christian element in their party, they all answered, like, earnestly, you know, God's such an important part of my life. And, you know, one of them literally said, like, you know, I'm a fallible person. We're all born sinners, and I'm only saved through the blood of Jesus Christ, obviously. And, you know, everybody applauds in the audience. Like, this is mad.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of strange that, like, you know, America's had a president that's mixed race, right? And they came within touch and distance of a female president, but the idea of them ever having like an atheist president is laughable. Like, you can't like it's absurd.
I can't remember something I was watching years ago because it's so out of whack with the rest of, I think, American society's genuinely actually become very secular. Like, it's something set in like California. It's Silicon Valley again, I think. And it was the idea that being called a Christian is like more litigious now than being called gay. You know, called gay. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a worse accusation in that part of LA. And yet, like you say, yeah, the idea of having a president that didn't pretend to be, I could actually see. Maybe not yet. Could you see a Jewish president?
More so than an atheist one.
Yeah. Maybe even I could see a Muslim president before an atheist.
Oh, I don't know about that.
How about a Muslim Republican president? I could totally see that.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, maybe.
But again, not an atheist.
Maybe like a Jewish Republican as well, you know.
Yeah. I think Jewish maybe work on it. I mean, because it was a big deal. It was a huge problem for Kennedy is Catholicism, right? So it's not even about, like, you know, like it's Protestant specifically. Like, they, I mean, he got elected, like, yeah, but they're nervous about Catholics still.
<It's>... Well, the evangelical vote is 80% turnout, which is remarkable.
Yeah, that's the problem, right?
Yeah, and that's why turnout matters, I guess, right? You know, it's because, yeah, which is, yeah.
I mean, our right has just as many problems as the American right, but I'm so glad we don't have that specific problem. I mean, on the contrary, you know, we're kind of technically a theocracy, right? Our head of state is also the head of the national religion, and we have bishops appointed to our second chamber. Like, it's not good.
Yeah. Anyway, should we tie this back in with the Fediverse at some point?
Which religion is the Fediverse most like?
Oh,
Hinduism, obviously.
Do you reckon?
Yeah. billions of gods.
Yeah. Makes sense. Yeah.
Lots of arms.
But yeah, I think, and I think in terms of the Fediverse, like this will just be all part of its natural, you know, process. Like it doesn't all, it's got more people now than it probably ever has had, but that's to, but it comes in waves. So there'll be, you know,
I think the fact that it's grown so much under the radar, you know, the antibodies that you were talking about, I think it's a really good way to put it. I think the fact that it's had so long to grow under the radar and now has such a strong sense of self, and not just one sense of self, but many senses of self. Yeah. I think those antibodies are strong enough to fight off anything.
I would hope so. It would have to be quite overwhelming for it to be a problem. So, and you know, it's been around for 10 years. But since Mastodon came along in, was it like 2018 or something like that, 2017. That's when it hit a new high, because to be fair to Mastodon, it made this like the whole sign up process, the whole UI, just a lot more intuitive and easy to.
Yeah, for sure.
To understand.
I remember looking at it briefly when, was it Identica?
That was one of them, yeah.
Yeah, I think I signed up for Identica and I was like, yeah, I love the idea, but this is not usable yet.
No. And so, yeah. And you know, all throughout Mastodon's existence, Eugen has taken an eye to the UI and how important it is. And there have been substantial changes, including the now default single column, you know, look.
A bit sad about that. I think one of the things that surprised me when I first signed up to Mastodon was the multi-column thing, and I liked it a lot. I like having the federated timeline and the global next to your own timeline. It's nice.
Yeah,
I know you can still get it, obviously, but I think that being default is. I get it. I get the reason for the decision.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean it's gonna crack on, and you know, I'm you know gonna carry on using it until I end up just, you know, getting bored and moving on. I think one of the things I do like about it actually is there's no real penalty for just like, oh, if I don't want to do that now, then I'll just leave it for a few months or whatever and then come back. Yeah. It'll be fine. You don't, because the thing is as well, you don't get punished algorithmically for it, right? That's the thing that I think I dislike most about a lot of modern web stuff, is that we have these opaque algorithms that determine so much about our experience. And the trouble with these algorithms is that they have a sense of punishment, or they seem to have this sense of punishment. YouTube, it's been around for a while. If you don't post regularly enough, or if you post something that is experimental and doesn't work, like you get punished for it. Or something that's too short, or something that's too long, or whatever. And these goalposts keep moving with YouTube as well over the years. There was a time when putting out a video that was a minute long would have been considered just like self-destructive for your channel. Now it's a short. All these new rules that you have to come into, and I don't like that. And it's,
like you say, if you take a month off YouTube, you've tanked your channel, right? I mean, not killed it necessarily, but like it's done damage, and that's a concern. Whereas, yeah, Fedi, you can take a year off, come back, pick up where you left off.
It's fine. It's absolutely fine,
It's not trying to, you know, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook. They're trying to get you to do particular things. They're trying to get you to behave in particular ways, and the Fedi isn't at all.
Yeah,
wants you to do whatever you want to do.
Yeah. And also, of course, if you know, like for any, like if for any agendas that might arise, it's going to be different from instance to instance anyway, right?
Yeah. Like, which in itself is just far more interesting and far more human. Word I keep coming back to, Fediverse just feels like a human place.
Mm. Yeah, because it is like, you know, and I
Twitter's wonder, like an awful shopping mall.
See, I do wonder now, right? If for example, new piece of Fediverse software comes in that does have algorithmic timelines, what would, like, how, like, it'd be interesting to know how that would work, right? It would be interesting to know if there is a way to make the end user experience, I don't know, better or more interesting or like more distilled or whatever, whether or not how it would be received by the other instances. What you know, what value it could offer. Like, I'd be interested to see that, and also how would it work? Would it require
certainly
computing power?
Certainly conceivable, but that for some people, a non-chronological timeline could be more useful to them, right? The problem with Twitter isn't necessarily that it's non-chronological; it's the reason it's non-chronological. It's what they're trying to do with that ordering, right? The specifics of it. It's not. Yeah, I mean, I would always want chronological. That's my preference. I can see. Yeah, I can see that being potentially a thing. That would be interesting.
Yeah, but I think
if anybody tried to do the Twitter kind of non-chronology for the same reasons, I just think nobody would use it.
Mm. There is like a natural algorithm of sorts, or a thing that the same output, which is boosts.
Yeah.
In terms of like if something is interesting and popular and you know, like engaging, it'll naturally be boosted. The chance of you seeing it will be higher.
So that, I mean, again, that's the human. That's, you know, again, what Twitter purported to be and was at the start, maybe.
Mm. Yeah, it was. Yeah. So wonderful. Great. All right, should we seal off that topic? We've been on this for like a while.
How long have we been going? I'm just trying to look.
2 hours. 2 hours, 10 minutes, I think.
Did have a couple of TV shows and get. Have we got time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, my TV shows. First one, enjoyable trash. I'll put a trailer up on the thing. It's called La Brea, or La Brea. You know, the tar pits in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
I'll get the trailer up first. So the premise is, it's following this family, and they're in Los Angeles near the La Brea tar pit. And
how do you spell La Brea?
LA BREA. That's not full screening to my window properly. That's half a trailer. I'll just do that. Anyway, a big hole opens in the ground. Like there's an earthquake, and then there's a huge sinkhole in the middle of the city, and a bunch of people fall in, and a bunch of cars and stuff fall in, and the people who don't fall in are like, oh no, they're dead. And then no, cut to the people that fell in, and they actually fell into the year 10,000 BC.
Oh wow!
And they're trapped down this sinkhole in the year 10,000 BC, and it's a bit Lost-ish, but you know how Lost was always like creating mysteries and then not really solving them.
Yeah.
This is kind of Lost-ish, but every mystery gets solved quite rapidly. And it's kind of a cheap knockoff of Lost, to the point where there's a character in the show that says several times, it's like we're in a cheap knockoff of Lost, which I kind of love. I'm not self-aware with it. The trailer makes it look far better than it actually is. It's complete trash. The writing is quite poor. But I love the concept so much that I'm on board for it. It's enjoyable. The CGI is dreadful.
I did see a little CGI. It didn't look.
It's like a CGI saber-toothed cat and stuff like that. And it's a little bit laughable, but it's if you like schlocky, enjoyable trash, like B-movie kind of stuff, I'm really enjoying it. It's still airing. It's in its second season. I really enjoyed that show a little bit too much.
Wow.
Okay. Second one, if you're ready, La Brea gets mixed ratings on like Rotten Tomatoes and stuff. This show gets bad ratings. It's called Invasion. And the premise is the Earth is being invaded by aliens.
Mm-hmm.
But what's kind of unique about it is we as the viewer and the characters you're following, it's kind of you follow different characters around in different places in the world as the aliens gradually do stuff. And the aliens are very much doing stuff, but nobody knows what the aliens are there for, like what they want, what they're trying to accomplish. And that's kind of interesting. It's because I think in a lot of these shows, it's like, they're quite clearly invading. They're trying to take over. They're trying to steal our resources. They're trying to kill us all. In this, they're doing all those things in small ways. But you get the sense that like we're misunderstanding them. This, you know, we don't really get what they're trying to do. You know, and that's really nice. it's criticized for being too slow, for being a really slow burn, which I don't think is really fair compared to a lot of other shows. It's Are you familiar with a show called Black Summer?
No.
That's a zombie apocalypse thing where you just, again, it's got the same kind of idea where you just follow around different people, and it's not very theatrical. There's never characters talking to each other, exposing or anything like that. It's just you follow characters like running through the woods, trying to get away from these things and saying the odd word to each other. And it's a lot like that with a little bit more characterization going on. And I'm really enjoying it. It's rated at like 30% on Rotten Tomatoes, and I really don't get it. It's really, really good, really powerful, really tense, a really interesting idea with these aliens where you really don't know what they're trying to do. You don't know what they're about. We feel like you might just be misunderstanding them kind of thing. Some great characters, great writing, great acting. Like, I don't get why this show isn't rated. It's really good.
The trailer kind of makes it look a little bit like it could be anything.
You mean the aliens could be anything?
No, as in the show could be anything.
How do you mean?
There's a lot of people running around with guns and yelling.
I mean, I think that's more trailers than... It's actually very, very slow-paced.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're selling it on Sam Neill in the trailer quite a lot, but he's only in the first episode, spoilers.
Okay.
I'm really enjoying it. It's incredibly tense.
Well, fair enough.
And then given recent events, I tried to watch The Crown. Have you watched The Crown?
I have not seen The Crown, but like I'm aware of its.
I'm not going to trailer it, but I watched a couple episodes, and it's like it's filmed in the dark. Like the bit in the first few episodes is in like the 50s, right? 40s, 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like they just went into a room, turned all the lights off, and started filming. Everything's just grey and dark and weird. And it also wasn't all that good. So then I switched over to watching The Tudors, which is a show from like the mid-2000s, which is far less serious. But that's set in the Middle Ages, and it's really brightly lit. So it was kind of like very opposite. But I'm not necessarily recommending The Tudors if people haven't watched it. But I'm enjoying it.
With Henry Cavill in it.
Yeah. So it's very much about Henry VIII and the political, you know, environment around Henry VIII. But it's a bit, it's going towards schlocky. It's taking itself quite seriously, but at the same time, it's very soap opery, or it's trying to make it all very dramatic and very like sexy and a bit Game of Thrones-ish. But it's fun. It's a fun watch at the moment. Yeah, I'm enjoying
that one. Actually,
that
kind of looks like a much better show than both The Crown and Invasion, to be honest.
No, Invasion's superb. Or Stand By Invasion. But yeah, no. Tudor's really enjoyable, yeah. In a way that The Crown it isn't. I know a lot of people enjoy The Crown. I'm sure it's a good show, but yeah, it's not what I'm in the mood for at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit of, like, I don't know if you've seen the new Game of Thrones show, House of the Dragon.
I've not, no.
It's really good. I really enjoyed it. It got rid of a lot of problems that Game of Thrones had, but the trouble with it kind of was that it was all the way through very serious for the most part.
Right, yeah.
It was almost like it got rid of a lot of like problematic stuff that was hard to watch. They told you know, like it felt a lot not like nicer to watch. It was very interesting. The acting was great, the setting was great, the special effects were great. It was all really good, except it just lacked that little bit of levity, that little bit of campiness that all fantasy kind of needs.
That's where the Tudors is getting it right. I think it knows where it needs to be camp.
So, like, I hope and I think the Game of Thrones / House of the Dragon will have learned that lesson. I think season two, there's going to be some fun bits, especially considering that, like, spoilers a little bit, the actual main event, the war that the show's about, sort of begins at the end of the first season. The first season is kind of like the setup.
Right,
you learn the characters.
Prologue. Yeah.
Yeah, the prologue kind of thing. And So when the actual war kicks off, there's obviously going to be a lot of war crimes and all that kind of stuff. Well, I mean, it's not even a war crime if if it's, but like, yeah, there's going to be a lot of horrible stuff happens, and I hope they just find ways to like break that down so that it isn't just beating you over the head with "Isn't war bad? Isn't war bad?
Yeah,
isn't
right,
war bad
right.
for 10 episodes?" Which I think they will do, but I think they were so concerned on not getting it wrong this time around that they didn't ever take any risks.
Made them too cautious.
Yeah, a little bit too cautious.
I'm not saying this to be contentious, just like, you know that for me, Game of Thrones has just burnt its bridges. Not interested. I have no trust in those people or that franchise or however you want to phrase it. No trust at all. And I don't even care if it's good. I don't want to watch anyway. It's bad taste in mouth, you know.
Understandable. The people that wrecked it are no longer part of the show, and I like that
I've told you. For me, it's not even that final season. It's like, I think even like during season three, I was like, the edges are showing here. Like they're just you're recycling the same tricks. I don't think you have a point.
Okay, I mean.
It's like I don't enjoy Lord of the Rings either, right? Book film, I've tried many times. I just don't, and there's something about it I don't enjoy. It seems very thin. And Game of Thrones feels like has all the same problems. It's just a far more exciting version of the same thing. it's less boring, but not any less to me meaningful.
I have struggled with Lord of the Rings myself, so I can sort of see what you mean on that side of things. I was definitely a lot more charitable to. I'm very charitable to Game of Thrones. Like I'll seek out even the good bits in the worst of it, to be honest.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
I can kind of get that. I mean, but House the Dragon has brought on a lot of people that
yeah
had a bad taste with season eight, though. If you were sort of falling away at season three or season four, then
I mean, there were good bits after that. There were good bits right up to season five, six, I would say. And there were times when I very much enjoyed Game of Thrones. But yeah, I did. It just came a point where I felt like, not the TV producers, I think George R. R. Martin, I don't think he knew the entire arc before he started. Yeah. So it feels like I don't think he knew what is. He had a lot of cool characters and cool situations, but I don't think he had a point. And at some point, you need a point.
Yeah. There's definitely points in more of a point in House Dragon, although they tend to hit you over the head a lot with that point. Right, so yeah. it maybe swung the pendulum a little bit far. Kind of maybe in the other direction. I don't know.
I think George R. R. Martin is very much concerned with like deconstructing fantasy tropes, right? Fantasy got to a place where it was very staid and a bit silly. Mainstream fantasy, and he wanted to deconstruct that and problematize it a little bit and make it a bit darker and ambiguous and all that stuff. And that's great. And for the first couple of seasons, that was great, but. Again, you need a structure to hang that around for it to be really anything more than kind of like a fantasy sketch show.
Yeah, yeah, that certainly makes sense. Do you want to hear a show that I have enjoyed? It's on Channel 4. It's Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared. Did I talk about this last show?
I don't think so.
Okay, phew. Right, I'm going to have to make written notes at some point. But yeah, so Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared. It's on Channel 4, 6 episodes. It's all out on the 4OD, 4 Catch-Up website. I think they're still going through releasing it episode by episode on TV. It is derived from the YouTube shorts of set in like this kind of children's TV show, but with a very dark and sinister undertone. And it actually turns out, or not turns out, but like things are not quite as they seem, and it's all very dark and funny, but dark and funny, you know, very, like, it'll make you cringe, it'll make you laugh, it'll make you recoil. And I think that they've definitely hit like a new high with this Channel 4 show. With the longer full episode runtime, they are allowed to like explore a lot of themes and do a lot of interesting dialogue stuff that they weren't able to do in like the short 4 or 5 minute YouTube videos.
Right, right. Is the premise, it's a Muppety thing?
A Muppety thing, yeah, Muppety. Yeah.
Okay.
So the basic, very basic premise of the show is every week has a theme, like electricity or jobs or family or something like that. And then it all, like, and then they have this like anthropomorphized character that comes in and will explain to them something, and then it'll all just go wrong. It's amazing. Like, the first one is jobs. Right. It's like why everyone should have a job, and if you don't have a job, you're terrible, and all this.
I'm getting the vibe of like Sesame Street, but like it goes twisted and dark.
Yes,
but while keeping that aesthetic and
yes,
yeah, yeah,
and it's like they push up against the fourth wall a fair bit, like quite a lot, and they like sometimes they'll just like talk about things like, you know, why certain things can't happen, or like why is it like, oh, I think the red guy, who I believe is actually called Red Guy, says, oh, it'll be all right, there'll be someone along in no time to talk to us about vegetables or something.
yeah it's making me think very much of that. There was again a YouTube thing, I think it was called like the GNU Stallman show or something. Do you know what I'm...
the GNU Stallman show,
let me find it. It's something like that.
The GNU Stallman quest.
No, oh, what was it called? Again, it was puppets explaining, oh, this is it. I'll link you.
Yeah.
Seems to be the same kind of vibe.
Okay.
The Hello World program. I don't know where I got the GNU. Yeah, it's hard to explain, but it's got that same like Muppets but dark kind of feel to it.
Oh wow!
Well, at the same time, like... explaining things about Linux.
Oh wow! I'm gonna have to check that out after the show.
That's great.
It's like Nightmare Fuel. It's not like, but not so hardcore, right? Like not real Nightmare Fuel, like. It's really comedy with it's really comedy masquerading as horror, maybe.
Yeah.
Or something.
Is that twisted? You take a children's thing and twist it, and you get interesting things, right? Interesting things for sure.
And it's the best thing I've seen on TV for a while, to be honest.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah, and the thing I like about it, and the thing I know, the moment I realized I knew that this was something that I really like, was when I kept like remembering jokes from it in my day-to-day life. You know, it's just and if I see anything that reminds me of it, I'll just laugh. Like, it's just
there's a show, it's not new, but I just come across it, called Kunk. I think it's a character that was in one of Charlie Brooker's
things. Yeah,
yeah. And then they just spin off Kunk on Britain and Kunk on Earth. And I've watched both of those over the last couple of days, and it's kind of old school. It feels like kind of 90s comedy. It's kind of old fashioned in a way, but it genuinely made me laugh like many, many times, like laugh out loud watching it alone. Really enjoyable. There's a bit where in Kunk on Britain, she's describing Edward Heath joining the EEC. She says, he joins the EEC in what should have been called Brentrance, but wasn't. Just burst out laughing.
And actually, there's a lot of that kind of wordplay humor in Don't Hope You're Scared.
Right.
Like, where they just take a word and sort of twist it around a little bit, or like there's a great one where there's an episode about family.
Yeah.
And the three of them in the house, right, they go, well, we're not a family. What are we then? Are we a clump? A clump of friends? A bundle. Yeah, can we have right, a, like, right. So, and then, yeah, like one of the duck character asks, oh, can we have a bundle meeting? Because they don't quite know what they are. So they use these collective nouns that just don't quite make sense. And it's like, and they first define a family as a group of people who share a lawyer.
That does sound, yeah. I was going to have to give that one a watch.
Yeah. Oh, I totally recommend it. It's like I say, I'm not even hesitating or even, you know, like exaggerate when I say it's because I mean, I haven't seen it on TV before. I mean, even it's better than it was on YouTube. On YouTube, it was very YouTube, right? Like a little bit salad fingers, that kind of thing. But when in the context of television, where it's got a little bit more space to flesh out the jokes a little bit more, to lay a setting a little bit more, it's just so much better. You get to, like, because it gets to parody things, it gets to contextualize things. It's British humor, so I don't know if it is likely to connect with us more than a lot of American stuff, maybe. There's a lot of social commentary on it. Some of it's subtle, some of it's not. That's kind of funny as well. I can't recommend it enough. Like I've seen it twice. It's only six episodes, half an hour a piece. So you'd be 3 hours, you'd be done. You know, you'd be through the whole thing.
Yeah, knew that. No problem.
It's I cannot wait for. I hope season two comes along. It's just fantastic. And it's hilarious. It's like it's made me laugh so much, and the end is interesting and sinister as well. The end, the final episode, is basically a puzzle that gives you the remaining clues to work out what the show is. So if you want to be like really geeky about it, it lays like, and there's lots of the clues in it are just so. There's one episode called Death. They explain death to the audience, right? They never actually imply or they never assert that their audience, like, is actually there, least of all our kids.
Yeah,
like,
right.
It's kind of interesting in that regard. So they maintain the fourth wall in that regard. And this name David keeps coming up. And it's like they don't know who this David is. And it's never explained, except you do, but there is a reason why the name David keeps coming up. I won't say, because that is a substantial spoiler that takes away the fun of it. But it's like there are clues in it that are just... So, like, it's you get as much out of it as you want to put into it, right?
Yeah,
if you just want funny jokes and funny wordplay stuff, you'll get that. If you want to, like, work out, like, what stuff means, if there's anything in it that you think is unresolved, it's probably not. There's probably the clues in it that explain who someone was, what happened to someone, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's amazing. And in the last but one episode, they even bring in that trope of something quite... like game changing happens, but the end of the episode makes it all go back to normal.
I it's very rare for me now to find comedy that actually makes me laugh. Maybe just because on the internet, like, comedy has become so sort of fractured. Like, you know, there's the shit posting, which is, you know, literally one line thing that amuses you in a very particular way, or, like, you know, the Zoomer humor of like layered deconstructed memes that don't really make any sense, but like in some way. So, like, just like old-fashioned comedy just doesn't do it for me anymore, generally speaking. So finding Kunk, that was nice, something old-fashioned that made me laugh still. And this thing sounds delightful as well. It sounds kind of like got the bit a bit of the spirit of it's gonna sound weird to younger listeners than that, but what Ren and Stimpy had back in the day.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to go with Brass Eye.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Yeah, yeah. But that's, I think, you can't just do Brass Eye now because that would be very passé. But that, you know, that sort of like slightly rebellious, slightly... I'm trying to think of a word for like being kind of intentionally a bit disgusting, but not in an outright disgusting way.
Like obtuse or...?
Just a bit weird. A bit unsettling. That's the word I'm looking for. Like unsettling kind of humor. This is about the show you were talking about.
Yeah, it's I'm surprised it's on the BBC YouTube channel, which I assume means that it's broadcast on Kunkon. Yeah, Kunkon Earth trailer, BBC.
Oh, just trailer though.
Is it not broadcast on the BBC?
Yeah, but I don't think it'll be on the. I think it's on iPlayer, and I think for the rest of the world, I think it's on Netflix.
Oh, okay.
And for everybody else, it's on piracy.
Yeah. I go straight to iPlayer these days. I don't even
really.
I don't even have a TV.
No, I don't have a TV, but I find iPlayer just the fact that stuff gets deleted after like 30 days of broadcast. Most stuff, I know they keep certain stuff on, and but that's part of the confusion for me. Like if it was like Netflix and everything was just there all the time and I could choose when to watch it, I'd probably use it quite a lot. But like the fact that I don't know whether it's going to be on there or not means that I usually just go to other places.
Well, I quite like watching Gardener's World on iPlayer.
And yeah,
that does go back quite far. Like, there's never any risk of that. Yes.
Have they stopped doing that so much? Maybe because it used to be. I think it stayed up for. If it was something that was aired, it was 30 days after it was aired, and then it wasn't there anymore, or something like that.
That was the old. That was a policy at one point. I think.
Right.
Like, I'm just gonna go on something like. I got Frankie Boyle's New World Order. What have we got here? Series 5, Episode 1. Okay, so it seems... Oh, okay, so this one only seems to go back to the latest series, really?
Yeah, so that's because I'm a serial rewatcher. If I like something, I want to watch it, and then a few days later, watch it all again.
Really? I'm going to just search for it, see what Frankie Boyle's... Oh my god, it's taking me out of iPlayer for some reason. Oh no.
See, this is what, it's confusing and weird. And it doesn't, like, I just want a list of things I can watch and I click on them and watch them.
Frankie, okay, there we go. I pressed enter
I've used Channel 4 one a few times, and that one seems to be a
Channel
bit 4's
all right, except for the adverts.
I don't remember getting an advert.
Yeah, oh, there are many an advert on Channel 4 iPlayer now. Okay. Not Channel 4 iPlayer, 4OD.
Yeah.
It's I hear they don't. I don't have as many adverts on Pirate Bay, but I couldn't possibly. Cool. You played any good games lately?
One game to talk about. Song of Six, with six spelled SYX. Songs, I think, of Six, which is how does it describe itself? A fantasy city builder, and it kind of is a city builder, but like I think somewhere it calls itself a city state simulator. So it's the usual like city building mechanics or colony building mechanics, but then you're on a world map with other civilizations, almost like Civ style. And I've not got this far in the game yet, but at some point, like you're gonna need to build up big and then butt up against them. And there's like a conquest game. At that point, it's a bit Dwarf Fortress-ish. Mm-hmm. Like it's got, it's quite complex and freeform. And it's in that thing I was talking about last week of like shitty graphics. This isn't shitty, it's actually quite beautiful, but it's not, what is it? It's simple graphics in a way.
I'm seeing a scene that looks like it's a city lit by just like the lights of night.
Yeah. It looks really nice, right?
That's amazing. Yeah, that does look quite nice.
Yeah, no, it's really nice looking game, and it's complex. I was kind of tired of city builders because city builders are kind of they're kind of puzzle games in disguise where you just got to like figure out the ratios, and once you figure out the ratios of everything, like how much bread production do you need then it's like kind of solved, and you can just build it any size. Then whereas this feels like way more organic and at the moment, I'm just kind of taking my time. I don't want to deal with that like army stuff for a while. So I'm taking my time and just making like an agrarian, like farming kind of society, like town. And I don't really want to get bigger than that for a while. I'm just, very much taking my time with it. And that kind of feels nice. It doesn't feel like there's a huge pressure to expand quickly or anything like that. And it's set in a kind of low fantasy world where you've got different races. And you can sort of there's a race that's they're kind of like pig faced dudes, and they just eat vegetables, and they're kind of like their needs are a bit more basic. So you can sort of choose based on your immigration policies, like how easy you want the game to be at certain in certain ways and stuff like that. It's a bit weird, and that's part. I'm going to skip forward in this video, but it's a bit weird, and that's part of what I like about it, I think.
Which wins low fantasy again?
Low fantasy just means like not too much magic.
Ah, right, gotcha.
Like you got your fantasy races and your fantasy setting, but not a huge emphasis on magic.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, when you start the game, you got this huge world that's going to have other city states on it, and you pick a particular region, and then within that region, you choose a particular square to have your settlement on. So you're part of an immense, and this is on the small map, and you're part of an immense world that you're going to have to deal with at some point. I think that adds a bit of interest as well.
Mm. That's really quite something. I always feel that the best city builder games and games, you know, city builder adjacent games are the ones where, rather than, as you say, are a puzzle in disguise, there is a degree of like creativity in that.
Yeah.
Like I like Open Transport Tycoon or Open TTD. It's not really called Open Transport Tycoon Deluxe, is it? Because that's copyright or whatever. But with Open TTD, I like the idea of having a robust public transport network without like air travel, for example. And sometimes like I'll go even further. Sometimes I'll be like, I want to make a really successful bus company and just do buses. You know,
that's sort of picking and choosing which bits you want to engage with, and yeah, like you say, creativity. Yeah, this very much has that. Like I say, I'm trying to keep it simple, because there's technology. Oh, they do technology in an interesting way. So you can build a laboratory where your boffins research technology and spend that in a tech tree. But different to, I've never seen this in a game. I'm sure it exists in some game, but I've never seen it where technology is something that has to be maintained. If some disaster happens, if there's a plague or something, and you can't afford to employ your scientists anymore because everybody's growing food, then you will forget the technologies that you knew. And you won't be able to operate your like metal production anymore because you've forgotten how to do that. And I love that. That's great.
I like that. That's good. Yeah. It looks really good. I really like the set. And I love when, and usually I think you tend to see this with indie games. Sometimes bigger games do this as well, where they focus on like a coherent, nice looking style before they actually focus on the fidelity of the graphics. That's been a hit with me. Nice, you know, like a solid, consistent style will always beat fidelity graphics to me, I think.
Mm, no, definitely. Yeah. Because it's actually very beautiful looking while being, you know, I guess lo-fi would be the word, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of sumptuous. Sumptuous pixels with beautiful lighting. Because it really does. Yeah, your cities at night. Once you've got a decent sized city and you can build torches outside for lighting, and night falls. Yeah, it looks beautiful. It really does with all the torches and the lights and the candles and the lights coming out of the houses and stuff.
Cool. I think the only game I've been playing lately has been, interesting enough, Hitman Blood Money. I've gone back to that, and I don't entirely know why. I think partly it's because I like games where you can dip in for maybe an evening or whatever, and then.
Oh, sorry. Can I very quickly interrupt you just to say something? One more thing about so. What one thing that I really like about this game, Songs of Six, is there's a demo on the Steam page, and what the demo is a previous version. It's like one or two versions behind the main version, but it's the entire game. So if you want to play the entire game, just a couple of versions behind release, you can do that for free. And so somebody in the Steam forums was saying to the dev, like, isn't this is terrible business practice? Like the fact that, you know, essentially you can just play the game for free if you want to. And the dev was just like, no, I'm perfectly happy with that. That's fine. That's my kind of
Sorry. I mean it's nice that, like, you know, even if you're going into it with a business mind of sorts, that you're not in it to make all of the money or maximize profits at all costs. Like, sometimes it's just enough to make enough money, you know? Like,
and at worst, it's just they're that confident in their game, you know what I mean? Yeah. Which is, that's cool. Anyway, sorry. Love money.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, that's that to me, actually, in even in the business world, I always feel is kind of important. Like, a lot of the, not even just the economy, but a lot of, like, the business world runs on trust and confidence. Like, if you see a business starting to cut corners and trim stuff down, not necessarily rehiring staff that leave and starting to, like, you know, audit all the little things that they would usually overlook and all that stuff, it does, like, stuff like that, when that happens, doesn't always fill you with confidence, does it? Like, it,
and well, it's then, also it's when you feel like you as a, you know, as their customer or consumer or whatever you want to call it, like, are being utterly distrusted. You know, like, you know, back in the day, you had to sit through the piracy warnings on DVDs, which, if you'd bought the DVD, just made you want to pirate, you know, because they cut that out. And, you know, DRM and all that kind of stuff. It's just, we're assumed to be untrustworthy, stupid thieves.
Yeah. And, you know, we're not. We're very competent, trustworthy thieves, I like to think, you know?
Exactly.
yeah. I mean, you know, I buy my stuff from Bandcamp, so, you know, that's...
Well, So this game, it was £20, this Songs of Six, and I was like, that's a bit expensive for me at the moment. I don't have a ton of money at the moment, but I was like, I'll play the demo for a bit. And then I saw what the demo was, and I saw that post that I mentioned. I was like, fuck it, I'll give this dude my money. It's worth it.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, it says here you've played 34.7 hours.
Yeah, it's one of those where I've played, 30-something hours, and I feel like I've barely scratched the surface, in a nice way, you know, like, in a, my time, it feels very organic, it doesn't feel gamey. If it, like, I've got my little people walking around my village, and, you know, I know some of them by name, and I'm like, oh yeah, Claire's off to the woods to get some more wood. She's happier in that job, because her race prefers working in the woods than being alone, and, like, you know, that kind of stuff. It's, like, it's really lovely.
Is this the kind of game you join the Discord for?
I don't generally join game Discords.
I have a little folder, but they're mostly open source games, to be honest, because I kind of want to see what the development's like.
Sorry, go on.
Because I kind of like seeing how the development's going. You know,
I could see somebody doing that. I generally don't. I find that if I get too much meta information about a game, I start thinking about its systems and its gaminess too much, and I lose my immersion. So I want to prolong that feeling of just, like, you know, discovering it for myself, kind of thing.
Absolutely, yeah. But I think the only game I've been playing lately is speedrunning Hitman Blood Money, which is kind of interesting, because the newer Hitman games, the bigger, the grander, the more... they're not quite AAA games, but they sort of they touch it, right? They're good games, certainly no complaints. They're bringing out new bits and pieces for them all the time, but I keep coming back to the older game because it's smaller. If that makes sense, so much that it's just like
simpler, right? As well,
it's simpler. It would. There are some things I'd love them to have brought into Blood Money, maybe different, like have the same levels, but slightly like. You know, maybe a little bit more sandbox. You make better, you know, more use. But this is back when this game was being made. All of these newer concepts were, you know, still in their infancy. So, not a genuine criticism of the game. But it's great for speedrunning, and I love the little speedrunning things that I do in it, and it getting to know kind of the mechanics of the game. So almost like breaking that immersion that you're talking about with the other, you know, six, where like you're like saying, okay, well, this person's going to be there, this one, and that's really quite fun. Also, I can, once like I've got a good strategy down for a level, I close the book on it. I like move on to the next one. It's like, once I can do that,
well, I think enjoying a game for its gaminess and mechanicalness is that's what you do when you've played a game inside out, right? You know, all the immersion's gone. But you still want ways to enjoy it, so you engage with it in that way, and that's totally cool. But they're both enjoyable in different ways, so I want to just prolong the... I'm not saying one is necessarily better than the other, but I do have a... So, you know, I love the game Mountain Blade.
Mm-hmm.
The original Mountain Blade back in the day, and then Warband, which was kind of a minor update to the original Mountain Blade. But so Mountain Blade Bannerlord, which is the new Mountain Blade, just came out of Early Access. It's been in development for... Been in development for a very long time, and it's just released. And it's kind of similar to what you were saying. It's so back in the Mountain Blade Warband days, they announced Bannerlord, and I was like, great, yeah, a more up to date, you know, higher fidelity version of Mountain Blade with like more stuff to do, because it was very much they were adding systems. That sounds amazing. I was really looking forward to it, and then I've been playing it throughout. It does just feel like Warband was simpler and more focused. Like, there's definitely more to do in Bannerlord. It's definitely, really, it's a better game, but I don't enjoy it as much as I do Warband.
Yeah.
It is just adding, there's way more stuff to do, but I don't want to do any of it. I just want to do the core thing that I could do in Warband. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like Warband is more distilled.
Yeah,
focused.
Yeah. And I don't want to piss on it. It's you know, if somebody's going to play the series for the first time, yeah, absolutely get Bannerlord. You'll love it. This is just like old man shouting at cloud kind of thing in a way.
Yeah. It kind of looks good. It looks like one of those games I'm not going to have enough time to play, to be honest. Like. Mm. See, this is why I kind of like at least with me, why, like, I'm turning my eye a lot more to the open source gaming space. And actually, one of the reasons for that is because it's such a smaller.
Yeah, it's kind of bite-sized, right?
Yeah, it's bite-sized. The games that come out tend to you know, you can play for an afternoon and that's, yeah, that's fine enough. And, yeah, you know, they tend to be a little smaller and a little, well, so substantially smaller and often more focused around a singular mechanic, yeah, or that kind of thing. Yeah. And not necessarily just open source games. There are a few indie games that I think are really quite good on itch and stuff like that. But largely it's like big games where, you know, I mean, I couldn't even really pick up Morrowind if I had the chance today, which is, you know.
And if you did have the time to play a long-term game, I would really want you to get to play Crusader Kings, because I think you would love Crusader Kings.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, that'd probably be where I'd go. Either that or Tales of Hood.
Tales of Hood is great as well, yeah.
That's really, I had a really good time with that, even though I didn't really get much out of my starting village.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah.
But it was just like, I loved it. Like, you know, it's...
No, that's a wonderful, and it gets so much better when you do get out into the mysterious wastelands. Similarly, it's an open source game. I can't remember what it was, but something I was doing made me want to play Cataclysm Dark Days Ahead again. I played it back in the day. I've played it a fair bit, but it's one of those games, it's a full-on proper roguelike, and I've forgotten all the key bindings, so I need to learn it all over from the beginning again. So I'm intending to watch a couple of hours of videos and then get into it. I've got it installed and all that, and actually I can run it. Oh, that is not obeying my tiling. I won't run it. They're going to be seeing half of Cataclysm. I'll quit that. But yeah, it's an old school style roguelike. It's essentially a very complicated, complex game where you can I believe you can craft a car from like raw material in this game. You can build a base, but what it is essentially, it's like there's a zombie apocalypse, but I think there's also every other kind of apocalypse. There's sentient fungus, that I don't know, whatever apocalypse you can think of, it's probably in there. It got a very robust crafting system, but I just want to survive and escape from zombies for a while, and I'm looking forward to getting back into that. And that's, yeah, it's a good open source game.
Wow, it looks pretty cool just looking at some random YouTube videos. It looks a little bit like Tales of Hood.
They're both like full-on roguelike. Although I did play Tales of Hood lately, and they've added a non-roguelike mode, which I'm really glad of, because I think that game would play better as just like a normal RPG than it does a roguelike. So they've added... they've added checkpoint saving when you go to villages, and I think that's way better for that game. I think if I play it, when I play it again, I'll play it that way. I think because you get to the point where I've been to the point where I've got 45 hours invested in just one character, and there just comes a point where I don't want to go anywhere new, because if this character dies, I'm going to be devastated. Like, I'm deep into the story, I'm deep into the lore, I'm deep into the world. Like, I want to go further, I want to know what's going on. Mm. But I didn't, because I'm just going to lose my character. Yeah. So yeah, treating that as a non-roguelike, I think is better.
Yeah, for sure. I like roguelikes, but I think when you've got something that kind of builds its own plot, right? Like then you have too much to lose, I guess, don't you?
Whereas Cataclysm Dark Days Ahead, like, yeah, you might have built like a base that you've invested very hours in, but it's kind of a flat world. You're not really getting into a narrative and progressing through a story or anything, so I'm okay with, you know, I died with 100 hours invested in base building. I can cope with it in Dark Days Ahead.
Yeah. Cool. Right, we're coming up to 3 hours now. We should probably wrap it up. But cool. All right. Well, thank you everyone for joining us. Let us know if you made it to the end of this rather long.
No.
We'll be back when we feel like it. And
if you did make it to the end, you get a free copy of Cataclysm: Dark Days Ahead.
Very nice. Very nice. Very very. Sought after. I yeah, thanks for joining us. We're still probably working out how this goes, but that's life. We don't have a Patreon, we don't have a sponsor, we don't have much. if you want to support and the podcast, right, you can either leave a comment or feedback in one way or another. That's always nice. We're on the Fediverse. Or if you are one of those people that likes giving money, how about just give money to a good free and open source project instead? They would do more with it than we would. We'd probably spend it on drugs or something.
Or donate to your Fediverse server.
Or we'd probably donate it to Fediverse or something. Cool. So, yeah. Thank you very much for joining us, and I hope you have a nice day. Toodaloo.